Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
Big time card coming up this weekend. As always, one half of your host and duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, Matt Allen on the respective socials at Matt Allen FNP. And Matt, we're coming off of a big UFC 263. I mean, listen, a title changed hands. There were some big upsets on the card. And coming into this weekend, we have UFC Fight Night, Ige versus the Korean Zombie. Or should I say Korean Zombie's world, because for Chan Sung Jung, this is 8th straight main event slot. And unlike our last Fight Night card that we did have, there were plenty of fighters on that card coming off a loss, coming off of 2 consecutive losses, fighting for their jobs. Well, these yuppies are all in pretty good company. A lot of fighters coming off of wins and a lot of really interesting matchups that I will assume might fly under the radar this week, but there's a lot to look forward to out of this card.
Two of my underrated favorite fighters in the whole entire roster, Tim Means and Matt Brown, fight. Now listen, I just really enjoy watching those two guys fight. They've been around forever. It's exciting when you get the chance to watch two kind of legends of the welterweight division compete in one weekend. So I know I'm oddly excited for this card, but like you said, the main event with the Korean Zombie, it is 8th straight main event. It's kind of a wild stat. It's like when you look back and you see Kareem Abdul-Jabbar made 18 All-Star games, you're like, wow, that's just a lot. Like, 8 main events. You not only have to be popular, but you have to be extremely successful to be that, not only that much at the forefront of the sport, but in the headlines constantly. And for the Korean Zombie, not only has he maintained his popularity throughout his whole UFC run, but he's always seemed to get better throughout each and every one of his fights, and that's why I'm so excited for this weekend's main event.
Except for his last one, which obviously plays a lot into this. So, obviously, tons and tons of matchups. Matt Brown, Tim Means, we're just missing like Mike Pyle and we get a Legends division up there, but really looking forward to it. So many great fights. So let's throw it on over to our Fight of the Night screen, as always brought to you by Manscaped. And it's a bit of a cheap pick, but our main event, I mean, the Korean Zombie taking on Dan Ige. For Dan Ige, you look at the losses, Julio Arce in his debut in the UFC, UFC 220, and then his second to last fight, his last main event, against Calvin Kattar, and it didn't go so well. And for the Korean Zombie, 8th main event, we talked about it before, in a row, well, he didn't look great in his last main event either. Now, for Dan Ige, he had a great comeback win. He picked up a very, very quick knockout of fellow Canadian Gavin Tucker, fellow Maritimer, or should I say Atlantic Canadian, originally from Newfoundland. But when I look at this fight, I mean, the Korean Zombie, he always tends to bring it with stand-up. Dan Ige cutting the angles, working in some of the wrestling, that extreme couture way. Love this fight. And for the Korean Zombie, too, training at a fight ready this time. So it's really interesting.
If you go off nicknames alone, this has to be Fight of the Night. You've got the Korean Zombie fighting guy who's nicknamed after the very bonus that he tries to win every single fight in 50K. I think this is going to be an absolutely wild main event. And listen, the Korean Zombie and Dan Ige might not really be championship fighters when you think about it, but they're two fighters who always make a very entertaining and exciting fight. And I think that's all what we really care about.
Definitely looking forward to it. And as always, the Fight of the Night screen presented by Manscaped. Make sure you check them out. Manscaped.com. Use promo code FNP. You're going to save 20% off and get free shipping. I'll talk about my nuts and their products later, but Matt, we have a great card coming up. And it should be a great card coming up. 13 fights as of Monday night. If anything falls out, we'll update it. We're going to have a weird week this week. Question mark kicks will fall on a night, and we'll kind of get you hip to that one. So make sure you're checking us out on the socials. Twitter, at Fight Night Picks. Again, you can always find us at Craig Allen FNP, at Matt Allen FNP, and on Instagram as well. We also got some great content out there. An interview with Julian Arosa, who's fighting this week with JHK MMA. You can also find our box break with those Panini Prism cards. You can find that over there. Shouts to those who tuned into the Fight Companion over the weekend, getting the chance to win those green parallel cards that we gave out. But not ruining the surprise, make sure you check out some of that content. I am really looking forward to this card, Matt. So without further ado, as we always say with Fight Night Picks, let's get into it. It's always fun in a fight when we have a big-time clash of styles, and in this fight, we don't. We have two really, really good grapplers and good wrestlers as well, with Brazil's Lara Procopio, and she's taking on King Casey O'Neill. For Casey O'Neill, undefeated, eternal MMA prospect. She came in with a win on UAE Warriors, we've seen a lot of fighters here recently. Carlson Harris being one, Manuel Fiorot at 125 pounds, and Casey O'Neill was able to get a win with UAE Warriors, get the bug in McMaynard's ear, and end up in the UFC. And listen, originally she was supposed to take on, in a super short notice spot that ended up going to Lilia Shakarova, she was supposed to fight Lauren Murphy, eventual title challenger, and I say that like I can see the future, hopefully. But I can't. And also, we're not clairvoyant, so we got to get that one out of the way pretty early. But she was supposed to take on Murphy. It didn't happen. And then she ended up with a really interesting fight against Shayna Dobson. It was coming off a Maria Agapova win. So it was a big-name opponent in a roundabout way. Listen, Casey O'Neill looked great in that fight. And she's a fighter that used to train out of Tiger Muay Thai, a main training partner of Loma Lookbunmi. You'd see the two fighters on each other's Instagrams. Made the move over to the States, out of Vegas. Listen, big time camps, and we can really get into it. I mean, 10th Planet Jiu-Jitsu, Casey Halstead doesn't get enough credit. I think he should. And you saw in Casey O'Neill a great fight and a great game plan her last time out.
No, she did look really good, and that's going to be the key going into this fight is, can she improve upon what she looked like in the Shayna Dobson fight? Because for me, listen, Shayna Dobson's an interesting fighter, and we've always had differing opinions on her because, listen, she was what? Does she hold the title still as the biggest underdog to ever win a UFC fight? Well, wild stat to have for Shayna Dobson. But we always knew that the grappling was her weakness. And the fact that Casey O'Neill beat her the way that she did, it was impressive, don't get me wrong. But that's the way you're going to beat Shayna Dobson. You're going to take her down, you're going to ground and pound her. And the question coming into this fight is, can Casey O'Neill have that same level of success against Lara Procopio? Because for Lara, she can do a lot of those same things that Casey O'Neill can. I just look at Lara as the slightly more refined striker out of these two. Because for Casey O'Neill, you talk about the Loma Lookbunmi connection and the fact that she did train at Tiger Muay Thai. Her striking is still quite basic. You always hear about the Tiger Muay Thai connection. But I never look at Casey O'Neill and think, wow, she's a fighter who can really go out there, march behind her tie stance, and throw a lot of light.
And for Casey O'Neill, her father, I had this written down from the last time, Cam O'Neill, he's the promoter, the owner of Eternal MMA, and she talked about it in a comment under one of our videos. Somebody was just giving her the business and getting really upset about it. She responded to the hater, and listen, credit where it's due, she put her money where her mouth was and won that fight handily against Shayna Dobson, so you get the credit. But again, her dad was a pro kickboxer, and she's a bit of a different breed. She has the grappling, the wrestling, and everything, so to speak. For Lara Procopio, I didn't really know what I was going to get coming into the UFC. I had a bit of an idea, and you look at it on the regional scene. She was a Shooto champ at 125 pounds and 135 pounds. Came into the UFC and fought Carol Hossa. Carol Hossa's a really good fighter. That was a split decision loss that honestly could have gone either way. Procopio was actually the one shooting the takedown. She went 0 for 5, but Carol Hossa has really good takedown defense and a super wide base. They struck on the feet, and Procopio looked good, and that was the one kind of knock that I had on Procopio coming into the UFC. Her striking didn't look great. Well, looked really good in that fight. Then she takes on Molly McCann. Might have had the stats in front of me. 11 minutes and 43 seconds of control time in that fight, and she looked amazing. So she gained stock in a loss by striking with Hossa. She looked really good against Molly McCann. Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, former champ with Shooto. Listen, neither one of these women have a ton of pro MMA experience. So really, it's going to come down to the fact is who's more well-rounded or who has that upper echelon in one discipline.
And for me, honestly, I think the discipline comes down to cardio. I know that's not really a discipline in MMA, but when you look at the overall skill sets of both these fighters, they do complement each other very well. For me, it does come down to the cardio, because let's say Procopio does start to just give up an inch with her takedown defense, then I do see Casey O'Neill being able to at least chain some of her wrestling transitions together and getting this fight to the mat. And this should be interesting. Who's going to be able to out-scramble the other one in these takedown attempts? Because I don't see either fighter just being able to secure a regular takedown attempt. I see most takedowns in this fight causing a scramble and then either one really having a 50-50 chance of ending up on top. And that's the fun thing. I don't just necessarily see Casey O'Neill going for the takedown and oh, she's going to end up being the one on top, because for Procopio, she is someone who can scramble after her back does hit the mat, and that's something you really have to like out of her. Because with O'Neill, I do look at her more as I'm in my full guard than I'm in half guard. She is much more of that traditional I'm in these set positions, where I look at Lara as slightly more able as the one who could scramble her way out of a bad position.
And for O'Neill, she has had a 10, like in those Eternal fights, and let's point out a couple of them just to give you some examples. So UA Warriors, she beat Christina Stellew, finished her. The Caitlin McEwen fight, you can find all these fairly easily. The Mickey Motono fight, again, maybe not the biggest of records, Jada Kelty, but somebody has to start somewhere, right? If you look at those, sometimes she will go from half guard right into mount. Like, she will flip into some of those positions. But when I look at the odds, Procopio open to minus 175. She's minus 149, minus 150 right now. Casey O'Neill open to plus 150. She's plus 123. If we have a look at Tapology, 738 total votes, 80% O'Neill, 78% by decision for the 28% that are Procopio, 87% by decision. Kind of perplexing to me, to be totally honest with you. Listen, I see this fight as being very close. I see Procopio being a little bit more refined in just about every area. Casey O'Neill will fish for some of those takedowns that aren't maybe some of the most orthodox. I think Procopio is going to be able to get out of some of those bad positions. So for me, I'm going to go with the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt out of Nova União. You're going to see Andre Pedernares in her corner. A couple of pictures there on the Instagram with Jose Aldo and BJ Penn. But also Luana Pinheiro or Pinheiro to train with Pauliana Battaglio and Ariane Carnelosi in some of these closer weight classes. For O'Neill, I talked about it, 10th Planet Jiu-Jitsu, but also Extreme Couture. I could go on for days and days about fighters training there, but also fighters on this card from Extreme Couture. You're going to see one half of the main event from there in Dan Ige. But yeah, I'm going to go with Procopio in this one.
So the way I look at this fight is Procopio is the slightly more skilled out of the two, but I would argue that O'Neill, A, is the bigger fighter out of these two, and B, has a slight cardio advantage. I do see Casey O'Neill as someone who can push a slightly higher pace, because for Procopio, she has good cardio when it is at her pace and when she can keep things going at her pace, but I do think if Casey O'Neill can keep it going at slightly higher tick, she might be able to be the fresher fighter in the third round. So for me, it really comes down to who is going to be the better fighter in the third round. Can Procopio get to such a lead to where the third round won't matter? I am going to have to agree with Craig on this one. I do think Procopio can defend enough takedowns early on in this fight to get off to enough of a lead throughout those first two rounds and the third won't be as big of a factor.
Would it be a big surprise if O'Neill wins this one, though?
It wouldn't, because like I said, the wrestling is so even throughout these two fighters. So let's say O'Neill has a just slight hair of an advantage in the wrestling, and if she is able to stay heavy on top, I could see an avenue for O'Neill to win.
We're going to find out on Saturday night. Matt, both of us going with Brazil's Lara Procopio. Let us know down below in the comment section who you're going with. Is it King Casey O'Neill? Is it Lara Procopio? Is it the Korean Zombie? Is it Dan Ige? Let us know. Big fights coming up this weekend. You're not going to want to miss them. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Really neat fight coming up this weekend between a couple of once promising prospects. And normally when you don't fight for a long time and you're a fighter, you don't really get much better. But we'll find out what we get this weekend. We have Joaquin Silva taking on Ricky the Gladiator Glenn. And Matt, it is no longer Rick. We can say that for sure. Another James Lynch interview. So shouts where it's due with All Access MMA. He talked about the fact that when he was a kid and about grade two, his dad had a girlfriend named Ricky, and that's what forced him to become Rick. But now that he's a man and he's 32, he's claimed it back. He's Ricky. He's no longer training at a Team Alpha Male. He is out of, and I want to get it right, Absolute Martial Arts and Fitness in Des Moines, Iowa. And for Ricky Glenn, this is a guy that at one point, former World Series of Fighting featherweight champ, he beat Georgi Karhanyan, which is a win that still holds a lot of water, came into the UFC, and listen, is the record the greatest in the UFC? Kind of. I mean, it's 3-3, but you look at his best win over one Gavin Tucker, who we have to talk about more and more as we will in our main event with Dan Ige, but two guys with statement wins over Gavin Tucker, who's a pretty darn good fighter if you ask such people as, well, Joe Rogan or Craig and Matt Allen. But when I look at this fight for Ricky Glenn, it's really tricky for Ricky, and that's where the jokes will stop with his name, because the 5-on-in, he beats Felipe Nover, one of the best grapplers we've ever seen. He beat Gavin Tucker, but let's go back to that. 4 years and 3 months ago, he beat Felipe Nover. 3 years and 8 months ago, he beat Gavin Tucker. Lost the decision to Bellator's and YouTube fame, Miles Jury. Matt, how long ago was that?
3 years and 5 months ago.
Beat Dennis Bermudez by split decision 2 years and 10 months ago. And beat, lost to Kevin Aguilar 2 years and 6 months ago. Had major hip surgery. Had to take about a year away from training. He was supposed to come back not that long ago. And we already had a prediction video booked for Ricky Glenn's return to the Octagon. He's supposed to take on one Carlton Minus back in December. Forced out due to COVID. Him and a coach had both contracted it. So now we're here with Ricky Glenn. For Joaquin Silva, this is a guy that made it almost to the finals of the Ultimate Fighter Brazil. He ended up losing to the eventual winner, Gleyco França. But you look at it so far, knocked out Andrew Holbrook. But the other trouble for Joaquin Silva, He beat Andrew Holbrook almost 5 years ago. Beat Rezumadaddy by split decision where...
Didn't look good in that fight.
He had to come out in interviews and say, well, I was the guy that tried to finish him, so that's why I should have won the fight. Lost to Vince Pichel by decision. Nothing wrong with that. Beat Jared Gordon by knockout. That was 2 years, 5 months ago in a fight of the night where Jared Gordon dropped him at the start. He dropped Jared Gordon at the start or the end of the first round. Second round was wild. Third round, he gets a finish. And lost to Nasrat Haqparast in one of the first prediction videos we ever did on the channel. It's just weird to look at these two guys where Silva's been away for such a long time, but there's not much in the room of news or injuries out there on him. And he looks like an absolute unit over on the Instagrams. I'll post a picture, but he doesn't look much different than the picture that we have in front of you right now. For Joaquin Silva, he just goes balls to the wall from the first second of the fight. Ricky Glenn, a little bit more technical, but I have honest to goodness no idea what we're going to get. And if you chalk it up on the Fight Night Picks scoreboard, this is a garbage fight.
It's kind of wild that these guys are in a do or die fight against each other, because I'm going to have to quote Chael Sonnen to talk about something that you had alluded to. You don't get better at something by not doing it. And both of these guys fit that profile, because for Joaquin Silva, there were high hopes. Like, you're black belt in BJJ. You've got decent power in your hands. Like, there's some skills there that we can work with. If there was anybody else with those attributes, you'd be like, wow, he's what, 15 to 10? But no, the problem with Silva is he loads up so much on his punches and he's slow because of it. That's my problem. In MMA, speed kills. Speed is probably the most important attribute a fighter could have. And Joaquin Silva is slow. Like, slower than molasses on a cold winter's day, to quote our great-grandmother. She was great, I guess. Anyways, for Ricky Glenn, first of all, it's weird that you add the Ricky later on in your life, but besides the fact, and also, could his dad not have found any other woman with any other name than the same name as
Matt,
his son?
Don't deny 80s love.
I'm not.
Don't make fun of a man's name.
This is going to be a really interesting fight, because for Rick Glenn, where he has the most successes, he stands in the pocket and lands with volume. But the only chance Joaquin Silva is going to have to land on Ricky Glenn is to land when Glenn's in that pocket. Because for Glenn, the land where he will have the most success is the area where he'll be in the most danger. Because I don't really see Joaquin Silva as the type of guy who's going to go out there and take Ricky Glenn down. He doesn't really have just the pure wrestling to be able to shoot a double leg and take Ricky Glenn down. Glenn has A, too wide of a base, and B, really good takedown defense at that. For a guy like Silva to go in there and consistently get takedowns on him, I do think if Silva is able to get on top of Glenn, then that's a completely different story. I do think he could dominate him if he gets that top position. My issue is I just don't really know how he gets that top position, and there's a lot of things to like from Silva when I look at this fight, but at the end of the day, aside from the question marks I have around the hip surgery, I do like the takedown defense and the volume striking of Ricky Glenn. This fight on paper could be really fun or could be terrible. Like you said, it's a garbage fight because it could just be so many different versions of itself.
And that's the hard thing. Like, if you were going to try and put your hard-earned money on this one, I personally would stay away, because Joaquin Silva is a forever lightweight. Ricky Glenn moving up to 155. And he talked about it. I don't want to put my body through the weight cut anymore. The last time out, and he said it in the interview, All Access MMA, James Lynch, credit where it's due. He said that, listen, if I ever missed weight, I was going to move up. He missed weight his last time out, 148.5. So now we see him at 155, rejuvenated, ready, training at home again in Iowa. Lovely place. Never been there. Not to joke, I've been there before. But when I look at this fight, it really is tricky to try and figure it out. So again, both guys are only 32, but they've been off for so long. If you look at the odds, Ricky Glenn opened a minus 135. He's now a minus 104 or thereabouts on best fight odds. For Joaquin Silva, opened a plus 115. He's a minus 119 favorite right now. And if we have a look at Tapology and the votes, it's a surprise to you, surprise to me, but let's read them out. 695 total votes, 62% with Glenn, 88% by decision, 38% that have Silva, 68% by decision. Again, a lot of people are seeing a decision out of this one. Is it going to be the volume, I assume, against the power out of Silva? And just for me, again, full power, overhand right, bit of a low kick, left hook, good submission defense. That's what I see out of Joaquin Silva. Is that enough to win him this fight?
I don't think it is, personally. I do think the volume training of Ricky Glenn will be enough for him to win this fight. Again, I worry about his movement a little bit, especially after the hip injury, because if he isn't able to get in and out of the pocket consistently and fast, then I do think Silva might be able to land some counters on him. But other than that, I'm going to trust the offense of Ricky Glenn moving forward on Joaquin Silva than the off chance that Silva does catch him with a big shot on his way in.
Yeah, it is a really, really tricky one for me. So, like I said, wouldn't necessarily have it on my card. You look at it for Silva, out of his 11 wins, 7 of them are by knockout. but he hasn't fought in the longest time. He hasn't knocked anybody out since Jared Gordon, but who's to say that he couldn't? Because I think in a fight like this, he could definitely cause a lot of damage for Ricky Glenn out of the losses. Again, Miles Jury, Aguilar decision, Dennis Bermudez decision, Tucker decision. So maybe you do like that decision prop in a fight like this. I do like the volume striking of Ricky Glenn as well, but this is another one. I want to see both guys on the scale because Silva been out for a long time. So is Glenn, up a weight class. This is one especially that I'm saving for question mark kicks. But at the start of the week, I've got Ricky Glenn. If I haven't made it clear enough, I don't have a good read on this one. But I'm going Glenn off of prior fights. And again, I do like the track record and the fact that he has almost double the amount of fights as Silva.
Let's get into it. Yeah, no, I like Ricky Glenn. I just think, like you had said, his volume should be able to overmatch any of the power that comes back his way from Silva. I like the reach advantage that he has, too, because it's weird. Like you had said, for Silva, he is, like, he's jacked for lightweight, but he's not the biggest guy frame-wise. Like, the fact that Ricky Glenn is moving up from featherweight, I still expect him to be the bigger fighter on fight night, which is kind of wild to think of. So, I do agree with you. I do like Ricky Glenn.
Matt, both of us going with the blast of the past. We're going with the Gladiator. Iowa's own Ricky Glenn to get the win. Can't wait for this fight and the entire card. You got another great fight at 145 pounds up at the top. Danny Ye challenging the Korean Zombie. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Heavyweight Slugfest coming up this weekend. We have Josh Parisian out of Scorpion Fighting System taking on Guam's Roky Martinez. And we got really excited for Roky Martinez's debut in the UFC. I mean, it seemed like a long time coming type of thing. He had fought with Ryzen for the longest time. And listen, there are some big names on his record. He got finished by Mirko Krokop back in 2018. Well, he submitted Jerome LeBanner back in 2017. And if you go down through it, again, there are some big names there that you would recognize from the Pacific. But you look at this, a guy that trains still at a Spike 22 over in Guam, a guy that's loyal to his people, does great interviews with some of the television stations locally. And I really do like Roky Martinez's game. Josh Parisian coming in here out of Michigan, a guy that fought on Contender Series years ago. Back in, and let's get into it, 2018, first round finish over Greg Rebello. It was the win over the CS champ. Then he didn't get a contract right away into the UFC. He fought Michel Batista, he got finished. Then he went and fought Lights Out Championship 2 in 2019 against big time contender. And I think this is a guy you're going to see in the UFC this year, Brett Martin. He just had a big win just, what, a week or two ago. So after that, if you're Josh Parisian, do you hang your head low? No. He wins. And then he ends up on Contender Series. He beats Chad Johnson. And then he punches his ticket into the UFC. Loses to Parker Porter in his debut.
Not Matt, a good look.
We compared this fight in our mind's eyes. We kind of came together, did the old thunder, thunder, Thundercats. This is like a fight that we saw a couple of weeks ago. This is just like Chris Barnett and Ben Rothwell.
It really is, because for Josh Parisian, I know he talks about a lot about how, oh, I move like a middleweight. Well, you know what heavyweight weighs 265 pounds and moves like a middleweight? One Ben Rothwell. And yeah, he might not do the weird Dominic Cruz thing anymore, but he still moves pretty well for a heavyweight. And when I think about Josh Parisian, he really is just a smaller version of big Ben Rothwell, because Ben Rothwell does tip the scale almost as heavy as heavyweight can get, whereas Josh Parisian does sit more around that 240 range. And no, Josh Parisian's is big, because in my mind's eye, that's the thing. Ben Rothwell is absolutely massive, but for Josh Parisian, they do have that very similar style where it's not often that a heavyweight prioritizes their footwork, but for Parisian, he really does. And you do like to see it, because at heavyweight, it feels like a lot of guys just rely on their one-punch knockout ability and the fact that, oh, I can defend a few takedowns. And listen, Josh Parisian might not have looked that good against Parker Porter, but one thing that Josh Parisian is not is a heavyweight who goes in there just relying on his power. I think of him a little bit similarly to a guy like Tanner Boser, who, again, Boser's not going out there trying to put you out with one big punch. He will rely on his volume a little bit more. Now, Parisian, and he will tell you himself, does rely a lot more on some spinning techniques than some of those other guys mentioned, but he does remind you of both when it comes to the volume. For Roky Martinez, it's kind of weird because he's got this crazy kickboxing background. You know him for all the striking. But his last two performances, he has looked kind of underwhelming so far. And if you just take both guys from their last performances, you're not really having high expectations coming into this fight. But I do have high hopes that this could at least be a somewhat entertaining unranked heavyweight matchup.
You look at Roky Martinez, his debut was on incredibly short notice against Alexander Romanov. And Romanov. Like,
it was Roky, a bad fight for Roky.
Roky Martinez wasn't able to do anything, but he earned the opportunity. Then he took on Dontayle Mays, and he got outboxed, and he didn't really land much. And that was the thing. When you see a really good Roky Martinez fight, he's moving forward. He's throwing jump elbows up the middle. He's throwing jump knees. Like, he's a really fun fighter to watch. When you look at his last number of fights and his losses, again, Jake Hune, the Honey Bear, I love him. I love to watch his fights. He had a kickboxing fight against Carlos Ullberg, if you want a deep cut.
Ooh.
Big Jake Hune guy. And then Krokop in 2018 with Ryzen. Well, listen, Krokop's going to Krokop over there. But the wins, Ryo Sakai, who was 8-8, Saigo Mizuguchi, who was 14-7, and then Hideki Sakine. And Matt, listen, I love Hideki Sakine. Shrek, a guy that has a, what, sub-22nd loss to one championship's own, Alen Engolani. Is he ever going to fight Vitor Belfort? But Matt, when I look at this one, if it's a fun Roky Martinez, he's letting his hands go, he's getting wild, and he's giving one to take five, that doesn't really work out for me very well against Josh Parisen. But this is very much a 2008 heavyweight fight.
Without a doubt. And that really is a great comparison, because both guys do have somewhat limited skill sets. And I don't mean that
fun.
They are fun fighters, don't get me wrong. But it's not like either guy's going to be winning the heavyweight title anytime soon. And it's just not the ceiling I see for them. I do, though, see Josh Parisian as a guy who does have the higher ceiling. I see him as being, A, the more well-rounded out of the two, but B, the faster guy. Because you kind of mentioned it before we started. You were like, Roky Martinez has fast hand speed. And he did.
This could be the fight. You never know. Backs up against the wall.
Very true. And I do think that Roky Martinez not worrying as much about the takedown threat in this fight will let him at least use his stand-up game and allow his stand-up to flow a little bit more. But my issue is that I don't think this version of Roky Martinez was the version that we saw outside the UFC. And to be completely honest, I don't ever think that guy was really a UFC caliber fighter to begin with.
Aww.
I know that's hard to say. It's just he never really had any big top-tier wins coming outside of the organization moving his way in. I do see Josh Parisian as someone who can at least overwhelm heavyweights with his volume, and that's why a Parisian to win this fight.
All right, Matt, we look at the odds for this one, and I was a little bit surprised due to the fact that they are very close. If you look at it for Josh Parisian, he opened a minus 135. The line got down to about a minus 165. He's a minus 130 right now. For Roky Martinez, open a plus 115. He's at about a plus 105. So they are close. If you head on over to Tapology,
wow.
743 total votes, 89% Parisian, 65% by knockout. For the 11% that have Martinez, 53% by knockout, I've already picked some underdogs on this undercard. But for me, I'm going to go with the slight favorite that is, for now, Josh Parisian. It is a tricky one. If you decide you want to roll the dice, you're a wild, wild person. But I'm going to go with Parisian here ever so slightly.
This is the definition of pop and popcorn fight. But no, I agree. I've got Parisian. Like I said, I do feel like if anything, that Parker Porter fight lit a fire under him. And we will see a better version than we saw throughout his last outing. So I do think the volume of Josh Parisian will eventually win out throughout this
Matt, fight. Big time fight at heavyweight. Both of us going with Scorpion Fighting Systems' own Josh Parisian to get the win. Can't wait for the night. Chan Sung Jung taking on Dan Ige in the main event. You're not going to want to miss that. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
Really looking forward to a matchup coming up this weekend at welterweight. We have Matthew Semi the Jedi Semmelsberger taking on, is it Kalen? Is it Chaos? Is he the Ox Fighter? We're going to call him Chaos Williams. And for Chaos Williams, two huge statement wins in his debut. I mean, you look at it and wow, was 2020 ever an interesting year for Chaos Williams? He knocks out Alex Morono. He knocks out Abdul Razak Al-Hassan. He loses a decision to Michelle Pereira, and we'll talk about it. I mean, we have to, but you go back to that fight, it was really frustrating. I know it was a split decision. Chaos had more strikes. Pereira had the late takedowns in the second round. It was just an overall frustrating fight if you're Chaos Williams. And from what we had seen on his regional scene and from what we'd seen out of those fights, didn't really fight the highest level of competition. Had some nice wins. Really reminiscent of like a Daniel Rodriguez type where U.S. regional scene, I'm beating the guys I should beat in impressive fashion. I end up at the UFC in the UFC at 170 pounds. And he's had largely entertaining fights. That's what you're getting out of Chaos Williams, but kind of to the nth degree. So if you do look at it, I mean, 27-second finish, 30-second finish, and then a decision. For Matt Semmelsberger, this is a guy that spent 4 years as a strong safety at Marist College. He weighed over 200 pounds, and then it was a slow burn, coming down to, obviously, 170 pounds, weighing in at 169.5 his last time out. He had an amateur fight, and I'm not lying about this, against William Knight. You're going to hear William Knight's name throughout this night, But for Matt Semelsberger in the UFC, beat Carlton Minus. He was a big underdog when we made the video. The odds kind of got close. Picked up a really big win there. Got a little tired as the fight went on. And then his last time out, well, he didn't have to get tired. He knocked out Jason Witt in like Chaos Williams fashion, where it was just like, I'm going to pump the jab, go right cross, and just knock him out flat and cold. So a huge win for Matt Semelsberger. Obviously a guy that wanted to fight sooner, but this is the fight that he ultimately gets. And I talked about it as the intro, but Matt Semelsberger drove from Maryland out to Fit NHB to train with Tim Means. Said it wasn't the first time that he trained with Tim Means. And the way that I found that one out, it was an interview with one James Lynch for Pub Sports Radio. So shouts where it is. Traveled all the way out there a few weeks ago. Had to push his car at one point because it broke down about 3 to 5 miles. So listen, good conditioning out of Semelsberger. You know he's training out of an interesting camp in Albuquerque. But so's Chaos Williams because he's gone from... I don't know if they go Murcielago MMA or if they go with the Murcielago, like bat. But for Chaos Williams, now training out of Jackson Wink MMA. You see Holly Holm. You see Clarissa Shields. You see who? John Jones in the Instagrams. Matt, I absolutely love this fight. I couldn't tell you what they're going to have for dinner, but I feel like I've set the scene. What are you thinking about this one?
This is a great fight to start the card. It really is. And for Chaos Williams, he was a guy who I'd say we were pretty critical of coming into the UFC because, like you had said, he didn't really beat anybody before he came to the UFC. But he completely changed my opinion of him in two very short fights. And what he was able to demonstrate in the Alex Morono and in the Abdul Razak Al-Hassan fight was just absurd power. And when he does move forward and actually lets his hands go, it is an absolute force to be reckoned with because he has a really unique combination of not only crippling power but really good hand speed too. He's a guy you really have to watch out when he does get his combos going, but I keep on emphasizing his volume and his combos because in this last fight out against Michel Paella, he just didn't look that good. Like, he didn't throw his hands at all. He just kind of stood there and watched a lot throughout that fight, and it was a frustrating fight on many different levels because it was a fight that I think a lot of people are looking forward to as a potential fight of the night, and it did not deliver whatsoever. But the really frustrating thing was, and I'm almost certain this was the case, was both guys had so much respect for each other and each other's knockout ability is that they never really wanted to engage all that much. And that was a problem for Chaos Williams. The thing that we knew him for going into that fight was the thing he refused to do, because the thing with Chaos Williams is if he gets into those like 50-50, I hit you, you hit me kind of fights, he's going to be able to beat like borderline top 15 guys just on the off chance he catches their chin. I'm not saying technically he's going to be able to hang with those guys. I'm just saying he's got that 50-50 style where on the off day, he can pretty much catch anybody. And for Matt Semelsberger, I didn't really think much of him going into that Jason Witt fight. I thought, oh, okay, this will be an interesting matchup. I wonder how good his takedown defense is going against Jason Witt. But what he demonstrated was, and exactly what you said, he had hands like Chaos Williams in that fight. And that's what's interesting. Like, if he falls in love with his hands and tries to go out there and strike with Chaos Williams again, like he did against Jason Witt, A, terrible job by his coaches. I really doubt he's going to do that. But B, I see Matt Semelsberger as being the more skilled of these two fighters. I'm just worried that will he fall in love with his hands, especially after that Witt knockout?
That's a crazy thing, because let's talk about it this way and put it in these terms. Is Matt Semelsberger better than Alex Morono? I don't know. Is Matt Semelsberger better than Abdul Razak Al-Hassan? Well, yeah, in 2021, I'd say yeah.
Probably,
but,
yeah.
You know, 4 years ago, no. But if you do look at it from Semelsberger, if you do listen to the interview with James Lynch, and I'll link it down below in the individual video, because listen, again, props to the Canadian, but in that one, he kind of talked about the fact that, yeah, I know exactly the X factor. Chaos, when he plants and just throws wild bombs and he lands, you saw those two knockouts. But when you look at Matt Semelsberger, he'll toss in a little bit of the L-step, he'll throw a bit of a long kick. He's not the type of guy to go really volume heavy, but he will use his length to his advantage. And you saw that in the Witt fight where Witt just kind of walked forward and Semelsberger threw the right cross, hit him in the forehead and knocked him out. Like, it wasn't a lucky shot, but you don't often see a right cross where you're kind of standing still, putting your hand out to really land with that much power. So it is power versus technique. You know from Chaos Williams too, though, in the regional scene, you did see a little bit more wrestling. You saw some decisions that definitely went his way where he mixed in the volume and the wrestling as well. So it'll be interesting to see what we get out of both guys, what tweaks both camps use, because for Semelsberger coming out of Crazy 88 MMA, coach John DeBrug, who, apologies, I said DeBruggle in every single Semelsberger thing, so I had to get that one out there, but definitely has a good game plan as far as that jiu-jitsu is concerned. But I really do like this fight. When I look at the odds, Matt, Chaos Williams open to minus 150. He's minus 175 now. For Semelsberger, open to plus 130. He's at about a plus 145. And if we have a look over on Tapology, 745 total votes, 80% Williams, 86% by knockout. For the 20% that have Semelsberger, 63% by decision. I see this fight is close. The odds have it that way, but the fans don't necessarily see it that way. So what are you thinking here?
For as tempting as Semelsberger is as an underdog, I think I do have to side with Chaos Williams for the exact reason you brought up. Is Matt Semelsberger better than Alex Morono? I don't think he is. And Morono's not the most hittable guy. Like, I understand he's not elusive like he's, I don't know, Max Holloway or something, but he is a guy who can strike and he's got some technique on the feet. And the fact that Chaos Williams, I understand he didn't really use his technique to close the distance, but when he does bring that storm, it's a big storm that you have to weather, and I just think he's going to be able to land one of those big shots on Semelsberger at some point throughout this first round.
I mean, wish it, want it, do it. I don't know if we're going to get that. For me, I like Semelsberger and the fact that he can mix it up a little bit more. He can mix in that wrestling. To me, in my mind's eye, I think of him almost like a Christos Yagos at 170 pounds. He can mix in a little bit of the wrestling. He can do a little bit of the striking. Hopefully his cardio doesn't fall off after the first round, but I like Semelsberger in the underdog position. I can definitely understand where somebody, yourself included, and let us know, please, in the comments below who you have, because there's certainly going to be a lot of support out there for the Ox fighter. But for me, I'm going with Semelsberger. He's talking about using a lot of distance management. If he needs to get into the clinch, if he needs to rest a little bit, he can do that too. So for me, I'm going to go with Semelsberger as the underdog. You're going with Chaos Williams, but absolutely love this fight because it could definitely be fireworks. Really looking forward to it. And a huge main event at 145 pounds. We have 8-time consecutive main eventer Chan Sung Jung taking on 50K Danny Ige. You're not going to want to miss it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say, let's get into it. Couple of former Invicta strawweight champs going at it this weekend. We have Vina Janjidoba taking on Kanako Murata. And Matt, I was some kind of excited for Murata's UFC debut. This is a former national judo and wrestling champion. She won the 2011 Junior World Championships in freestyle wrestling. And you see that in every single Kanako Murata fight. She strikes. She can switch stances a little bit, get in nice and tight and close. Take the fight to the mat, really strong upper body, holds a lot of fighters down. And really, I looked at it and I wondered, hey, what kind of gym is she coming out of? She is coming out of, and I want to get this proper, Reversal Gym Shinjuku. And listen, I've seen it, Silver Wolf Gym, that's what we had her last time out. But she's training now out of CSA over in the States in Dublin, California. You've seen a lot of fighters coming out of that gym. Adam Piccolotti, Kerry Melendez were just a couple that I could pick out off the top of my head. But for Kanako Murata, you see her working a little bit of her striking just in the last couple of weeks in California to get ready for this one in Vegas. Kanako Murata, incredible wrestler. And we saw that in the debut against and I would say a good wrestler. Now, she didn't look great her last time out. She got totally out-judo by Luana Pinheiro. But Randa Marcos, you know exactly what you're going to get out of Randa every time. Kanako Murata went in there. I wrote down the scores, Matt. All three of the judges scored at 30-27 at the end of the day for Murata, who is going to be the smaller fighter just about every time she fights. And that was kind of a story of like 2020. We have these really small women coming in at 15 that probably, I would assume, would be atom weights. I know she was a champ with Invicta. Got the win over Emily Ducati over there. Split decision, but still a good win. And for Kanako Murata, you just go through that. Again, she has less fights. She's 12-1 so far. But the wins, Ducati, Magana, UFC alum. And then the one loss is to Rin Nakai at 125 pounds. Rin Nakai fought in the UFC. You know who she lost to? Misha friggin' Tate and Leslie Smith has a win over Sarah Dalio and others. I mean, Tara La Rosa, big time wins. Kanako Murata, another one. Young Ji Kim. Big name. Rin Nakai, but still, Kanako Murata, very, very special fighter. Vina Janjidoba, one of the most accredited jiu-jitsu players you've ever seen in MMA. Two jiu-jitsu wins over Amanda Nunes. Need I say more? Like, really, really good.
For Verna Jandihoba, it is interesting because normally she's the smallest one in her fights, and she will have the size advantage, which is really odd. That was the first thing you brought up, which is funny because that's the first thing I thought of. I was like, wait, Kanako Murata is going to be way smaller, which is odd because I thought size was actually going to play a factor when Murata fought Randa Marcos. It did not at all. And I think there is a larger conversation there of, hey, is Randa Marcos good anymore? And listen, it's not for us to, like, we're not the judge, jury, and executioners on that subject matter, but she definitely hasn't looked good as of late. But the fact that Kanako Murata beat her, and she beat her by grappling, is by far the most impressive thing. Like, you can go out there and defend Reina Marcos' takedowns and force to become a striker. That's fine. A lot of people have done that throughout her career. But the fact that you go out there and you not only defend her takedowns, you secure takedowns of your own, and you just thoroughly out-grappler is a really impressive way to do it. And for Verna Jandihoba, that was the thing. We kind of went back and forth with her fight against Mackenzie Dern, and she's basically better than everyone in jiu-jitsu in this division, not named Mackenzie Dern. And that's the thing. I feel like a lot of people forget just how good of a grappler she is because the fight against Dern didn't go her way. But we're talking about Mackenzie Dern right now as like a top four in the division who should be fighting in a title eliminator or for the title. So the fact that Verna is, you know, A, probably the best name on her resume really does mean quite a bit. So I do feel like a lot of people are discrediting Jandihoba based on her last performance, while some people might honestly be overrating Murata based on her last performance as well.
And if you look at it for Verna Jandihoba, she came into her UFC debut, and that was on really short notice, lost the decision to Carla Esparza. It's going to happen. She beat Mallory Martin, she beat Felice Herrig, submitted them both, and Felice and Mallory Martin are, you know, 15 and below in this division right now, and then lost that one to Mackenzie Dern. Now, there were 29, 28s out there. It was a close fight, ultimately, against a very, very good fighter. So now we end up with this fight, and again, I can't stress to you how good Verna Jandihoba is at jiu-jitsu. Beat Amanda Nunes twice in just grappling matches. Also beat Claudia Gadelha. It says something. Now, Claudia, whatever. But it does say something. So, I look at this fight in terms of the odds. Jandihoba open a minus 125 favorite. She's a minus 150 right now. Kanako Murata open a plus 105. She's a plus 123 as it sits. And if we have a look over on Tapology for the total votes on this one, surprise to us as it is to you. That is a surprise. 755 total votes, 55% Murata, 87% by decision. The 45% that have Jandihoba, 48% by decision, 45% by submission. There's a couple of degenerate 2%ers that have her to win by knockout. But Matt, it is a really tricky one. Murata is so good at judo, so good at wrestling. Jandihoba is so good at jiu-jitsu. It is a real interesting mix of styles.
So for me, this fight could go one of two ways. Either Murata looks amazing and defends a bunch of takedowns, looks really, really good, and is the fresher fighter as this fight goes late and can somehow outstrike Jandihoba, or Verna can use all of her high-level MMA experience, which that's the real key between these two. Jandihoba has fought the much higher level of competition throughout her career. Even when she wasn't in the UFC, I would still say her wins and her resume stack up much higher than Murata's does. So for me, I actually do think this is one of those fights on this card that really does come down to experience, and that's why I have to pick Verna Jandihoba.
Verna Jandihoba, I mean, wins over Janaysia Maranjan coming into the UFC. Mizuki Inoue. Again, it's a split, but that fight shouldn't have been a split. So a lot of really interesting mixes, again, with the clash of, I would say, styles, but it's the backgrounds and grappling, if you will. If you can make a strong case for Kanako Murata, let us know down below in the comments section. I'd really like to know who you're going with in this fight. I'm ever so slightly going with Jandihoba again, but when we're talking about those wins in the UFC, not really against the greatest level of competition, Janaysia Maranjan not in the UFC, and Mizuki at 125 pounds just really hasn't been there. So it is a tricky fight to try and pick. I'm going Jandihoba, so are you. But we have a great fight coming up this weekend. And I think if Kanako Murata can get the win, holy smoke, she is on a fast track up to the top of this division. Great fight coming up at 145 pounds in our main event. You got Dan Ige, you got the Korean Zombie. You're not going to want to miss, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Bit of a head-scratcher fight coming up this weekend at 205 pounds. We have a guy that, honestly, you're probably surprised that he's still even in the UFC, Nicolae Negomarianu, and he's taking on Alexa Kammer. And Matt, a lot of people are familiar with Alexa Kammer, this guy coming out of Strong Style in Independence, Ohio. Trains with one Stipe Miocic, former heavyweight champion, all-time legend. And then there's Alexa Kammer. This is a guy that came off of Contender Series. All of his wins to that point had been by knockout. He makes a big entrance into the UFC, picks up a decision win over one Justin Ledette, former heavyweight. Little bit of a similarity in this fight. Negomarianu, former heavyweight. And then he ends up losing to William Knight by decision. And it was a weird one because, well, you knew exactly how crisp Kammer's hands were going into that fight. You knew how good William Knight's striking could be, but also he had that added X factor of strength and conditioning and wrestling. And that's ultimately what won the fight for William Knight. So for Alexa Cameron, can he get his hands going in this fight? Because for Nicolae Negomirianu, we saw it in his debut. He took on one of Matt's favorite fighters that we've ever seen on the UFC roster in Saperbeg Safarov.
I love him.
And he absolutely looked awful. And then it's weird because Negomirianu, the one knock on him was the fact that the competition that he faced outside of the UFC was, well, putrid. I mean, it's 37-81 was the combined opponent's records coming into the UFC. His first six fights were at heavyweight, and then his last four were at 205 pounds. But if you look at it for Negomirianu, really great judo throws, really aggressive wrestling, really wild striking. He's the type of kind of unfinished prospect that you like to see coming into the UFC. I think of like Ali Askab Hizriev that we were supposed to have fighting Kyle Daukaus. When I went back and watched the tape, I went, oh, those guys are a little bit similar, little wild, crazy throws, lots of fun. Or, you know, Alexander Romanov, but he's a lot more with the, what does he have? A sumo background in addition to his other talents. So for Negomirianu, coming in here, maybe not out of one of the bigger gyms that you've ever seen. It is Brozov. What is it? Dynamo Brozov. You see him training at the PI this week with Hamzat Shamayev and Alexander Gustafsson. So really interesting there. But Negomirianu, I loved everything that I saw coming into the UFC. He came in on short notice, replacing one Gokhan Saki to take on Safarov. So it was super short notice, somewhat close to home, you know, close to Romania, but not so much. But when you look at that, 29-26, 29-26, 29-27 were the scores. Obviously, the reason why it was a 29 was because that was one of the weirdest fights I've ever seen. Safarov decided, I'm just going to grab the cage a dozen times, but only lose 1 point. Negomirianu was on his back most of the fight. Also grabbed the cage to try and pull himself back. So it was just sloppy, but he looked really bad against Safarov, a guy that never looked very good in the UFC. So it's really tough to justify 9 wins, one awful loss, and then, hey, what are we going to get years later? Like, this is Stefan Sekulic-type territory.
For Negomirianu, that's the real question. Like, he was given the golden ticket. He was. Like, you got Saperbeg Safarov. Fighters wait their whole life for that opportunity because it's a showcase fight. Like,
sign on the dotted line,
like,
will you?
It'll change your life. Honey, we made it. We're fighting Saperbeg Safarov. We're probably making a $50,000 bonus. Like, you get excited for those opportunities. Because, listen, we throw the term scrub around. Like, I talk about Saperbeg Safarov the way Stephen A. Smith talks about Kwame Brown. And I truly believe it, because Saperbeg Safarov is a straight-up scrub, and there's no two ways about it. And that's why when Negomirianu lost to him, I was so surprised.
Now, for Saperbeg Safarov, master of sport and combat sambo, and we saw it in that fight.
And it just never translated. It never did. I'm sorry, Saperbeg, if you're watching this, but listen, I'm not a fan. For Alexa Cameron, the question is he more than just a training partner? Because we're starting to get this weird flow of UFC fighters where it's like, hey, this guy's here now because he's training partners with X, Robert Whittaker, Nick Diaz, like whoever it is. We're just starting to get main training partners all of a sudden come into the UFC, and sometimes it works out, and sometimes it doesn't. And for Alexa Cameron, that was kind of how he was marketed. You really set up perfectly. He was the, I'm Stipe's training partner, and that's great. Like, yeah. Stipe's gonna need some top-level guys to train with. But when you're only really being marketed as that, don't get me wrong, he had impressive performances up until that point, but that was the thing the UFC kept on shoving down your throat, was this is his training partner. Like, oh, he trains with Stipe, he must be good. And then for him to put on such a disappointing performance against William Knight, it really was disappointing, because the best version of Alexa Camber, this last thing from me, the best version of Alexa Camber is a high volume, very technical, I'd say compact light heavyweight, who's got decent takedown defense and cardio. We didn't really see that fighter his last time out, though, and that's why I have so many question marks surrounding this matchup.
Yeah, that's what weirds me out, because again, I see a lot of people out there on Twitter talking about this fight saying, well, look at the way that he beat Fabio Chiarot. He looked great. And I mean, Chiarot in his UFC debut didn't look all that good, but it was on day's notice. Chiarot's a good fighter. He has really slick submission abilities. Cammer looked amazing in his fight against Chiarot. Against Justin Ledet, looked pretty good. And then he had that bad fight against Knight. To me, it almost looked like a blip in the radar. But the same can be said for Negomirianu in his last fight against Safarov. So you take the good with the bad, and then you factor in the odds, and I find it a little weird. Now again, I think it's because of that Safarov loss and the fact that his opponents were 37-81 coming into the UFC combined. Although, the Hatef Moali fight just continues to look better. But if you look at the odds, Kammer, a big favorite. Open a minus 275. He's a minus 252 right now. Negomarianu, open a plus 225. He's a plus 200 right now. And over on Tapology, 670 total votes, 83% Kammer, 64% by decision. For the 17% that have Negomarianu, 53% by decision. There's a little bit of submission, a little bit of knockout in there. I have a really tricky time with this one, so I will defer to the fact that Negomarianu has a little bit more in terms of experience. He's a little bit more well-rounded if I look at the grappling department. His striking's wild AF, so it worries you because he gets hit a ton by lower-level fighters. Kammer has the avenue there, but, and I'll tip my hand, I'm going to go with the underdog in this one based on the fact that, again, he has that grappling pedigree. If this fight goes to the mat, it's probably not even going to be close. So I'm going to go with Negomarianu.
The grappling pedigree he demonstrated against Saperbeg Safarov?
Not against Safarov. All the way into the UFC. Takes a super short notice fight like that. I'm going to consider it a blip.
Against the guy who got outgrappled by Tyson Pedro. This is my problem. A blip on the road against Saperbeg Safarov is a big deal. Like, this is a guy who looked terrible against Jean Vallante. He got knocked out by Jean Vallante. Like, it's just a blip on the road against some fighters is one thing. Like, Poirier got knocked out by Michael Johnson. That's one thing. Michael Johnson on his best day can beat a guy. Saperbeg Safarov on his best day is barely a UFC caliber fighter. I think Alexa Kammer should be able to, if he can defend a few basic takedowns from the longer range. That's the thing I do like about Kammer. The one I would say high level skill he has is, he has decent footwork, especially if he is the one on the offense. He's got good L steps in and out of range. And I do think that he can take advantage of the wild striking of Negomarianu throughout this fight.
Matt, we're disagreeing on the pick. You've got the United States own, Ohio's own Alexa Kammer. I'm going to go fishing for the underdog. I'm going with Nikolai Negomarianu, but really like this fight because it's going to be one guy looking great and one guy looking awful, and we'll figure out which one we get out of that. But overall, a great card coming up this weekend. Alexei Olenek taking on Sergey Spivak in the co-main event. Two Fight Night pick specials. And then in the main event, Chan Sung Jung taking on Dan Ige. Absolutely love it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Matt, this weekend we have just a weird bucket of muscles of a fight because in an Arrested Development type of way, Matt Brown can whisper sweet nothings into Diego Lima's ear and just go, like Buster Bluth.
Oh, hey, brother.
Because for Matt Brown, he knocked out Douglas Lima years ago. Now, I get it. Yaroslav Amosov just beat Douglas Lima, and maybe the stars faded a little bit. Oh, wait. Yaroslav Amosov is an absolute undefeated monster of American Top Team. He is the next GOAT at 170 pounds, and I will die on that hill. But all this to say, Douglas Lima's a great fighter. He would have kicked it in the UFC 4 or 5 years ago. He could still have competitive fights against some of the best fighters out there at 170 pounds. Now, Matt, for Matt Brown to have that win from years ago, that's great. His overall record now is 22-18. A little bit of salt there. Immortal Martial Arts. You love to see it. Getting his kids involved. You see that in all the promos. He's a family man. He's 40. And John Anik will probably talk about that if he does call the fights this weekend. But he's taking on a two-time UFC fighter. And I say that because Diego Lima is one of those guys that fought with the promotion and then he had to kind of build his way back up. And if you look at it for Diego Lima, does he have the sexiest record of 15-8? No. But then you have a look at some of the names that are on there. A loss to Jason Jackson, who just beat Paul Daly last week. Good name. He beat David Machaut. He lost to Tim Means, Li Jingliang, Eddie Gordon in the finale of The Ultimate Fighter 19.
Bring up a win, Craig.
Jesse Taylor on The Ultimate Fighter 2015.
These are all losses. 25.
But the wins that he had before his last loss, Chad Laprise knocked him out. That was nice. Split over Court McGee, split over Luke Jumo, who didn't have a great time in the UFC. And again, a loss to Bilal Muhammad that just had a really big fight against Damian Maia. So for Diego Lima, we know out of him, we have a competent striker. He's decent at defensive grappling. He has some weird, tricky submissions that sometimes he gets caught in. Now he's taking on Matt Brown, a guy that is over 40, a little bit long in the tooth. Didn't look spectacular against Carlos Condit his last time out. So this is a tricky fight to try and pick.
If you get rid of the Carlos Condit fight, I would say Matt Brown wins this fight 9 times out of 10. Like, even just based off the Miguel Baeza performance, I'd say Matt Brown would still win this fight. If you can drop Baeza, you can knock out Diego Lima. Like, it's not impossible to knock Diego Lima out. He doesn't have a great chin himself. And that's why this is an interesting fight. Because if Matt Brown has suffered in any department, his durability has faded as his career's progressed. Like, you bring up the salty record. And I think you even you would have to admit, his record is salty because with Matt Brown, when you're fighting the best guys for as long as Matt Brown has, like, you're going to win and lose some fights. When you're only really in there with top 15 and borderline top 15 guys, your record won't look good after 15 years in the UFC.
So, 2010, Ricardo Almeida, Chris Lytle, Brian Foster, then Seth Bachinski, and those are losses. Then after that,
goes on a 7-fight finish streak.
2014, he loses to Robbie Lawler, Johnny Hendricks, beats Tim Means, loses to Demian Maia, loses to Ellenberger, loses to Donald Cerrone 2016, and that was a crazy fight. So, yeah, Matt Brown's fought some good guys.
And Matt Brown is one of those fighters who we talked about it with Tim Means a little bit earlier. I look at Matt Brown as he's basically exactly what Tim Means is going to be when Tim Means gets to that age. Like, he's Tim Means.
3 more years.
But there's a lot more wear on Matt Brown at this stage of his career than Means at his. Like, with Means, I'm still confident he can eat clean shots from his opponent. With Brown, I do worry a little bit. Like, it's gotten to the point now where when he does eat clean shots, it does at least hurt him. And with Baez, I guess, offensively, you can still see, like, Matt Brown is a force to be reckoned with. When he's moving forward, when he's landing punches, throwing his kicks, landing elbows especially, like, he's still a very dangerous fighter, and he can still offer prospects really hard fights. And that's kind of how I look at Matt Brown at this stage of his career. He's perfect for guys like Miguel Baeza. Like, I know I bring up the Baeza fight a lot to the point where Craig rolls his eyes, but I look at that fight as the best thing that's ever happened to Miguel Baeza. Like, you fought a legend, you had a hard fight, you struggled, but then you got through, and then you beat him. Like, that's the best thing. If you face adversity and get through it, especially when you're a prospect against a veteran, like, that's all you ever want from your prospects. The fight against Condit was a little bit concerning, though, because we didn't see Matt Brown get outstruck. We didn't see his chin fade. We saw him get outgrappled against Carlos Condit, the guy who gets outgrappled by pretty much anybody. And listen, Carlos Condit's looked better in his last two performances. You gotta bring big shouts to Condit against Court McGee. He looked really good. And then again, against Matt Brown. But I just don't think we're seeing the Matt Brown that we were seeing even back in 2017 and 19 when he beat guys like Diego Sanchez and Ben Saunders. Like, if you want to put Matt Brown in some of those legends fights, I'm fine with him fighting the Carlos Condits of the world. I'm fine with him fighting the Ben Saunders of the world. But him against Diego Lima, like, if Lima's on kind of a run, which he sort of is, I guess, if you want to call it, like, his only recent loss is to Bilal Muhammad. There's no real shame in that. Muhammad himself is the top 10 guy, so it's kind of weird that they're sort of trying to build the name of Diego Lima off of Matt Brown, because for me, this is a fun fight, but it's a dangerous fight for Diego Lima, because I've seen him get hit, and I've seen him get cracked by guys who don't hit nearly as hard as Matt Brown. The one thing I will mention, though, is this fight, to me, has shades of Diego Lima versus Chad Laprise. And listen, Chad Laprise isn't nearly as big as Matt Brown is at 170.
No, he's a 55 removing.
Exactly. And Matt Brown is a much better pure striker than Chad Laprise is, but they are two, I would say, chittier guys who are susceptible to the knockout, especially at 170. And when you look at Diego Lima, his record's kind of deceiving because he doesn't have very many knockout wins, but it's a guy who, if he lands clean, he can put you down. And at this stage of Matt Brown's career, listen, I've said it a lot of times, like, I love Matt Brown way more than I should. I'm probably the Matt Brown expert in the internet prediction channels, and I'm fine with having that moniker, but at this stage of his career, I don't think Matt Brown can beat a guy like Diego Lima. And it's not to say that Diego Lima's really impressed me as of late. You bring it up. A lot of split decision wins over fighters who, quite frankly, you expect Diego Lima to beat. But in the fight against Bilal Muhammad, he should be at least enough that he could beat Matt Brown. He defended enough takedowns. He was able to be at least good enough defensively with some of his striking defense to where he didn't get put down. Because Bilal Muhammad landed 100 strikes on Diego Lima.
Just got rocks standing up.
Exactly. But at least didn't go down from it. And against a guy like Bilal Muhammad, it's not like Matt Brown would have a competitive fight with him either. And I do think Diego Lima at least has more tread on the tires than Matt Brown at this stage of his career. And I really think that's what this fight comes down.
The weird thing overall career-wise, Diego Lima has a negative strike differential. Matt Brown has a nice positive differential by about one given to one taken. So it is interesting that way. Diego Lima's almost one taken to one given. If we have a look at the odds for this one, Lima opened to minus 185. He's a minus 173 average on best fight odds. For Matt Brown, opened to plus 160. He's a plus 142. Over on Tapology, 824 total votes. 80% Lima, 74% by decision. For the 20% that have Brown, 48% by decision, 45% by knockout. Both of these guys against statistically finished fights, or are in fights that finish. 9 minutes and 14 seconds, the average fight time for Matt Brown. 8 minutes and 43 for Lima. Big enough sample size. Again, Matt Brown's been around forever. Lima with the two stints. Both seasons of The Ultimate Fighter. Losing in the finals in both. Once to Jesse Taylor, one to Trek Gordon. But yeah, Matt, I've got Diego Lima ever so slightly, but if you can make a compelling case, you let me know down below in the comments section if you like Matt Brown.
So I do have Diego Lima, but I can honestly see this being a parlay buster of a fight. Like, I could see Matt Brown landing a big elbow in the clinch and putting Diego Lima down. We've seen Lima get rocked enough throughout his career that I do believe, listen, if Matt Brown lands a clean shot, there crazier things have happened than Diego Lima getting knocked out by Matt Brown. But no, I do agree with you. At the end of the day, I think Lima will avenge his brother's loss.
Matt, both of us going with brother Diego go to get the win. Big time fights on this card. Alexei Olenek taking on one tough guy in Sergey Spivak. And then in our main event, we have the Korean Zombie taking on Dan Ige. You're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up this weekend at middleweight. We have Wellington Turman taking on Bruno Silva. Now, no, it's not that pint-sized flyweight that's really been having tons of success knocking people out. It's the middleweight that used to knock people out, and now finally he's making his UFC debut. Now, I'm reading out of an article from SportsKita.com, and this was done back in May. A little bit of an interview Q&A with Bruno Silva. I'm going to read it word for word, so shouts to SportsKita where it's due. Your last fight was in November 2018. What was the reason for the long period of inactivity? Bruno Silva. I had a problem with USADA. I spent a lot of money to prove my innocence, but USADA doesn't impose itself. They want you to take over, and I would never assume something I didn't do. I didn't use it, but I was suspended for 2 years. I have my conscience clear, and that's why the UFC believed in me, supported me, and didn't fire me. But this is over now, and as I always go over the top this time, it will be no different. Matt, Bruno Silva was supposed to fight on short notice back in 2019 against one Deron Wynn. And I was over the moon because Bruno Silva is an absolute unit. And if you watched him fight with M1 Global, he knocked out Alexander Shlemenko. He knocked out Artem Frolov to win the middleweight championship. Artem Frolov was supposed to end up in the UFC at one point. He had a huge win over Diesel Joe Riggs before he fought Bruno Silva. This was when Craig Allen was getting super into M1 championship, and I absolutely loved the middleweights that they had. So for me, Bruno Silva was a great signing to the UFC. But again, back in 2019, this is direct word for word from MMA Fighting. On Monday, the United States Anti-Doping Agency announced that the Brazilian fighter would face a 2-year suspension after he tested positive for boldenone and its metabolite. I can't read it. So I guess I will end quote, resume quote, at a level inconsistent with boldenone meat contamination and the result of a urine sample collected out of competition back in May 27th of 2019. So Bruno Silva's been on the shelf for a while. He looks bodied the F up at Evolução Thai, training with the likes of Joaquim Silva, who's also on this card. But Matt, in MMA, in fighting, in most things, you don't get better with inactivity. So Bruno Silva probably would have got, like, again, a Deron Wynn or somebody around the top 15. I'd say Wellington Turman's around there.
No, he isn't.
The trouble is for Wellington Turman, since he's been in the UFC, he's also been very inconsistent. He beat Marcio Alessandre with Future FC in 2019. He booked his ticket. Lost a split decision to Carl Robertson. It'll happen.
Nothing happened.
Maluco Marcus Perez, the former LFA champ. And then he got knocked out, beaten pretty bad by karate guy himself, Andrew Aldearte Sanchez. Canada's own now?
This is a weird fight, Craig, because the best version of Bruno Silva, A, is a very juicy boy, but B, can knock out anybody, like anybody in the UFC. And I mean like anybody even in the top, probably like five, because Bruno Silva's striking really is that kind of pressure, and he has that kind of footwork and pressure to close the distance too. He's not just the guy who relies on his brute strength to go in there and knock people down. He's the guy who can get into the clinch. He does have good elbows. He does have good knees. Like, he doesn't just have to fight at that kind of brawling rage like we see guys like Cute Dalaba, for instance, use at 205. He can stay somewhat technical on the feet, although I will admit more technical guys like the Uriah Halls of the world, I'm sure, could easily split his timing and take advantage of some of the wildness of Bruno Silva, because to a certain degree, he fights like a modern-day Vanderlei Silva. Like, you are going to get those windows where you can counter him if you're a really technical striker. You can overwhelm him if you have really good cardio. If you're a really good wrestler, you can make him tired that way. If you're willing to turn on, though, you still have a lot of question marks, or at least for me, because for Turman, I had high hopes. At least going into the Marcus Perez fight, I thought, okay, this should be a fun fight. And it was a weird fight, because every Marcus Perez fight has been a weird fight in the UFC. But for Turman, leaving that fight, I was like, okay, it was good enough to get the win over Perez. Let's see what he does against Aldearte. And for Sanchez, it was another guy. He's been inconsistent. Is he a karate fighter? Is he a wrestler? Does he have good cardio? Does he have bad cardio? A lot of questions I still don't have the answer to. Wellington Turnbull looked terrible in that fight, though. And there's really no other way of saying it. He was tentative. It was like he was worried about the wrestling, and that opened up the striking for Sanchez. I understand Sanchez has more facets to his game than Bruno Silva, but at the basic foundation of that fight, it was Wellington Turnbull has pressure going backwards, and that's what Bruno Silva's going to do. So for me, I know Bruno Silva pressures in a very different way. He has to use kind of his power and his overall physicality as a pressuring mechanism and not the threat of wrestling. But for me, I really think if Silva can back Turnbull up, he will have tons of success in this fight. It really comes down to, can Silva knock Turnbull out before Silva's cardio fades? And to me, I think he can do that, but I'd love to get your opinion on where does Silva's power bar really fall and his cardio fall off a cliff?
Started his career 5-5. He's 14-1 since, and if you look at it, he has 16 finishes, all of them by knockout.
You
19 wins, 16 knockouts. Like, it's insane. And again, the level of competition. Fabio Aguiar's on there. He's fought some good guys. Like, we can really pick through, but the last two. Artem Frolov was almost in the UFC. Alexander Shlemenko probably beat Gegard Mousasi in Bellator, but they robbed him of a win. But
he also lost to Tito Ortiz, so not the hill I die on.
That's true. But for Frolov, yeah, he was supposed to end up in the UFC. I know if you go on his Tapology page, it doesn't show it as like a possible booking. He's supposed to fight CB Dolloway. Oh, wait, in the UFC, but he got hurt. And then he lost to Bruno Silva. So it's unfortunate for Frolov. But that's, again, that's how good Bruno Silva was. So I don't really know what we're going to get here. If I go off of prior performances, yes, I like Bruno Silva. I look at the odds. Silva opened, a plus 145. He's a minus 148 right now. Huge shift in the odds. Turman opened minus 170. He's a plus 121 right now. If I'm looking over on Tapology, Bruno Silva's the biggest mover and shaker at a 53% clip. So it does scare me off the line a little bit. When I look over on Tapology, 749 total votes, 83% Silva, 81% by knockout. For the 17% that I've Turman, 61% by decision. If Turman bites down on the mouthpiece and he's able to counter well, he could get a win. But I've seen him back up in fights and not look very good. I think that's what Silva's going to do to him. I like Silva here. But it's a shame that we lost 2 years of his career, because I think this guy actually is a pretty special fighter. He could lay an egg this weekend due to the inactivity. Turman could take over, because when he pressures, throws a kick, and mix in his combinations, he has really crisp boxing. I mean, 16-4 and you're not even 25 yet. That experience really does count. But again, I like the power to Silva.
That's the problem with Bruno Silva. Now, I will give my pickup, and then I'm going to quote Boss Fruden. I do agree with you. I think Bruno Silva should win this fight. Again, you can really go... You only can go off what you know from Bruno Silva's prior fights. And from what we know, he's a dangerous knockout artist. Now, Boss Fruden talked about Alistair Overeem once, and he said that sometimes when guys get off steroids, they lose confidence because they understand how undestroyable or indestructible they were.
Said it was an accident.
I understand. Allegedly. Just saying, if it was not an accident, and let's say it was something he was tinkering around with before he was with the UFC, all allegedly, but it is a confidence, or it takes away from your confidence. If that was something that helped you in your prior performances, and now you're competing without that thing, you might go into the cage knowing, okay, I don't really have that crutch to fall back on. I don't have that thing that did help me be good to begin with. Now, again, all allegedly, and maybe he was right and USADA just laid an egg and all the science was wrong and Bruno Silva was right. Maybe he is right, and I do agree with you, he should win this fight, but that's always something that just sticks in the back of my mind when guys do fail through USADA suspension.
Both of us going with Bruno Silva to get the win in his UFC debut. I love the fight, though. It should be great. You can't sleep on this one. Big fights ahead on the main card. You're not going to want to miss any of them. Just keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say, let's get into it. Big time banger coming up this week, and it was hard to keep this off of our fight of the night screen. We have Juicy J Julian Arosa taking on Sting Sungwoo Choi. And Matt, for Sungwoo Choi, in my mind's eye, yeah, listen, he lost a couple of fights to start his UFC tenure against really, really good competition. I mean, one, Movsar Evloev, who looked great against Hakeem Dawodu last weekend, and then to Gavin Tucker by submission in Calgary. It was a Canadian fight, Canadian fighter all the way across the country. We have a big country. And then he beat Suman Mokhtarian. And he didn't just beat Suman Mokhtarian. He beat him while Suman smiled, and he beat him so bad. That fight was a huge mismatch, and it probably shouldn't have happened. No. But Sungwoo Choi looked great, and he looked great his last time out against Yusuf Zalal in that one. So for Sungwoo Choi, really dynamic fighter. He can mix it in all different ways, but you know him as a really, really good technical striker, really nice high tie stance, very, very good striking defense as well. unless you're taking on the best of the best. And then it's really hard when Tucker or you've got Mavzarev Loya mixing in some of the takedowns with their striking. Sungwoo Choi, very technical fighter. Julian Arosa, not. And why can I say that? Because at Fight Night Picks, we have a great interview this week with Julian Arosa on our own GHK MMA. And Julian says as much. He says, Sungwoo Choi is a technical fighter, but I'm a little bit unorthodox. I'm going to mix things up. And I have those weird submissions that you don't see coming. And that's what makes him dangerous. And oh, by the way, that's what's made him dangerous his last two fights. Coming back against Sean Woodson, huge underdog, getting the Darce choke win, performance of the night bonus. His last time out, flying knee knockout over Nate Landwehr early. So Juicy J is riding a wave. This is his third stint in the UFC. Just like that Billy Talent song that I sing every single week. There's nothing to lose when no one knows your name. But everybody should know Julian Arosa's name. Not just because he fought an all-time fan favorite in the Polish zombie, Marcin Rocek. But because he fought one GOAT, Artem Lobov. And while he didn't win that fight, he won the hearts of many. Julian Arosa, Sungwoo Choi. Matt, I love this fight.
Julian Arosa, sneaky dangerous all of a sudden. Like, you're right. He's not a technical fighter. And he's not the most aesthetically pleasing fighter. Like, you're not paying to watch beautiful technique when you watch Julian Arosa. It's not like he's a Yair Rodriguez and you're going to be like, wow, with some of his techniques. But
this is like going to a rural spot in America or Canada and you want to see a demolition derby. Well, you're going to get Julian Arosa bringing in his Crown Vic to take on, like, I don't know, a Ferrari in Sungwoo Choi.
I was going to say, Julian Arosa, he's just like a farmer. He wakes up every day, goes to work. Like, he just knows what he's good at. And what Julian Arosa is good at is, and I hate to say it this way, but I do mean this as a compliment. He's great at taking punishment, accepting damage, and still moving forward. He is one of those classic fighters who, he will give one to take one, or take five to give one, I should say. But once he does finally get his range to his opponent, gets his hands around his opponent, he's a tricky fighter. And he's a fighter who, he will pull guard, he'll shoot weird takedowns. Like, nothing he does is all that traditional when it comes to the striking or the grappling department. And just go back to the Sean Woodson fight. I know Sean Woodson, he had that close split decision to Yusuf Zalal, and maybe people aren't as high on Sean Woodson as they were. But the reason people aren't as high on Sean Woodson is because Julian Arosa ate everything Sean Woodson had to offer and then choked him out at the end of the fight. It was just one of those classic Julian Arosa performances. And Arosa is starting to get into that, like, Nate Diaz category where it's like, I didn't lose, I just ran out of time, because it really does feel like he either gets TKO'd, which, okay, isn't a great look, loses a one-sided decision, again, not a great look, or wins by beautiful stoppage. And that's a really fun fighter to beat, and that's a fighter who can get a lot of bonuses, and this is a fight that could generate one of those bonuses, because for Sungwoo Choi, I always go back to the quote that Firas Sahabi said after Woo Choi fought Gavin Tucker, and it was, that kid's gonna be really good one day. Like, we did a lot of scouting on him, he's got a really, really bright future, and if someone like Firas Sahabi can see that potential in you, then, no, yes, I guess as of recent years, that might not be the greatest designation, but I will take his judgment and say, when a guy like that does say, wow, this guy's got a really bright future, you do have to listen. And the improvements that Sungwoo Choi has shown since that Gavin Tucker fight have been apparent. And you bring up the technique. I just like the well-roundedness of Sungwoo Choi at the end of the day. I like the fact that if he isn't there with a guy who's a better striker than him, he can shoot the takedown, and I'm not worried about his grappling. He's a guy who, if he's in there with a really good wrestler, he can defend some of the takedowns. Now, yes, I would say the wrestling department is one of his weaker areas, but still, the fact that Sungwoo Choi can go out there and he at least uses wrestling as an offensive tool is a really impressive thing. So this fight for me is kind of like every other Julian Arosa fight. Can Julian Arosa withstand whatever storm Sungwoo Choi brings into the cage? Or can Sungwoo Choi, and I hate to say this, can he look for a way out and find a way to get submitted by Julian Arosa?
Yeah, it is a really tricky one. For Julian Arosa, coming out of the same camp that we're going to see Casey O'Neill out of that also fights on this card, you got a little bit of 10th Planet, you got a little bit of Extreme Couture, you mix it all together. Sometimes you get something special. We've seen a lot of fighters. Now, for O'Neill, this is their second camp there. For Julian Arosa, he's been there for a bit. He also talked about it in the interview with JHK, that a main training partner that he had in the last year or so, and we saw him lose a fight, but that didn't matter, was Tristan Connolly. He said training with Connolly, being a bigger, thicker guy at 155, 45, really helped with the conditioning, really helped with the grappling. Two guys that were in there to compete against one another, to make each other better. And that's what Julian Arosa really liked out of that. Also, both of these guys, some of the bigger guys you're going to see at featherweight, they're not slim thick. They're tall and kind of thin, but they can really use those long limbs to their advantage. You see that out of both guys, over 6 feet tall at 145 pounds. Really going to be interesting to see who has a better use of length in this fight. So for me, I look at it, the odds, Julian Rosa open to minus 130, is a plus 112 right now. For Sung Woo Choi, open to plus 110, he's now at a minus 137. I'm eager to see the Tapology votes. We're seeing them as you see them. 731 total votes. That's a surprise. 71% Julian Rosa, 51% by decision, 27% by submission, 17% by knockout, 29% of Sung Woo Choi, 73% by decision. Sung Woo Choi coming out of Box Train as well as Vamos Boxing. Matt, I like the fighter out of South Korea here, out of Seoul. I mean, I feel like, listen, the technique's there, and as long as he can pop back up to his feet, which we've seen in his fights, I think he's gotten so much better out of his losses. I know he has much less pro experience. Normally, I account for that a lot in fights, but I really do like the technique out of Sung Woo Choi here.
I have to agree with you. I do worry a little bit if Choi is going for offensive takedowns. If he leaves his neck in a wrong position, Julian Rosa has kind of made a career out of Darce choking and guillotine guys who put their heads in wrong positions. But I do have to go with the overall well-rounded game out of Sung Woo Choi. I do look at him as the guy who can land first in this fight. And if he does have to go to his wrestling and his grappling, I think he's going to be able to handle whatever Rosa can throw at him.
Matt, both of us going with South Korea's Sung Woo Choi to get the win. Let us know down below in the comments section who you are going with. There's no wrong answers until, you know, a couple of minutes after the fight's over. So, can't wait for it. Big time fights coming up. Ige taking on the Korean Zombie in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Big time fight coming up this weekend at Bantamweight. We have a couple of guys in a rematch that's just straight up weird. Chito Marlon Vera, he's taking on Dangerous Davy Grant. Matt, we have to start off this video with you kind of putting yourself out there. You didn't know this was going to happen. You have to give an apology to Bishop Auckland's own Davy Grant.
I said Jonathan Martinez is going to be in the top 15 of either 145 or 135, and I was very wrong. Davy Grant went out there and knocked him unconscious and looked phenomenal in that fight. So it is from my deepest sincere regrets that I apologize to Davy Grant. Listen, Davy Grant, a much better fighter than I'd ever anticipated. And just think about Davy Grant. We talked about this last weekend with the co-main event with Devyn Figueiredo versus Brandon Moreno, how we like it when fighters, even at a later stage of their career, can still show improvements. And when I think about Davy Grant, first of all, I always think Davy, you say from the Navy, Grant every single time. But he's a guy who's continued to improve even at the age of 35. And it's kind of weird because unranked bantamweights don't tend to improve, especially at later stages of their career. And they tend to not find themselves in high marquee level fights against guys like Marlon Vera. So this is a huge opportunity for Davy Grant to capitalize on his very impressive performance last time.
This is the craziest thing. So when these two guys fought the last time, it was back at UFC Fight Night 84, Silva versus Bisping. Remember that? Marlon Vera was 9-2-1 at the time, just turned 23, and Davy Grant, he was 30, had just turned 30. Now, Davy Grant, 35. You've got Vera at 28. And for Davy Grant, his fifth to last fight, Damian Stasiak, who's doing the damn thing over with KSW now, he lost to him by armbar 4 years and 7 months ago. Huge layoff. Comes back, fights the Bermudez Triangle, who I saw fight for New England Fights his last time out. That's 2 years, 10 months ago. Loses. Then he takes more time off. He fights Grigory Popov, and he beats him. Then he takes some more time off. He beats Martin Day and knocks him out. Then he knocks out Jonathan Martinez. The guy's an old man knockout artist at 135, but the long inactivity for Marlon Vera, year 10 months ago, he fights Nolene Hernandez, who didn't have a good UFC run, but still made it, knocks out Andre Ewell, loses to Song Yadong in a back-and-forth close fight, then he knocks out Sean O'Malley, and then he loses to Jose Aldo. The level of competition's all over the place, but it's definitely there for Marlon Vera. Now, did not look very good against Jose Aldo, but that's easier said than done. So this is a really tricky fight where Davy Grant, the power's there. You know how good he is on the ground. I know I talked about submission loss to Manny Bermudez, but there was a point where the Bermudez Triangle couldn't miss until he fought Charles Rosa, and he just didn't look very good. And then Damian Stasiak, but again, that's 4 years and 7 months ago.
I might have been wrong about Jonathan Martinez, but here's the one I was right about. I've been right about Marlon Vera throughout his whole entire UFC career. There's not a lot of guys that I can say, hey.
Brown knows it.
It's true, though. With Vera, even when he fought Sean Lineker, I was like, there's a guy who is a special talent here. Like, you don't go in there and lose a decision to Sean Lineker and have a somewhat competitive fight without getting knocked out. Like, there's a lot of great fighters who have been knocked out by Sean Lineker. And the fact that Marlon Vera, even really young in his career, was able to have a competitive fight with Lineker showed me that, hey, there must be somewhat of a special talent here. And maybe he hasn't progressed the way everyone thought he would. He has a few losses on his career, but Marlon Vera is still a very, very good fighter, and he's become much more technical and as his career's progressed. He was a fighter who I always looked at him as, he's got good submissions on the mat, he's got great head and arm chokes, great front chokes, very similar to kind of like a Brian Ortega. I understand not as developed with the submissions, but with his aspect of the guillotine's really good, and he's got great head and arm chokes. But Vera then developed great leg kicks. Now he's got great stand-up, and I know his work with Jason Perillo has really paid off. That's a guy who he went to Ruka, and then all of a sudden you were like, oh, Marlon Vera got hands now. And it has been a really good progression for him. You have seen, though, that there are limitations to his striking. Like, this Song Yadong fight was a very close fight, but even I had that fight for Song Yadong. I understand Marlon Vera was very upset, and a lot of people had it for Vera. I understand. Just because I said it doesn't mean I'm right. Vera could have claims to win that fight. He didn't win the Aldo fight, though. And like you said, it's very hard to beat Jose Aldo, especially at 135. But when you beat a guy like Sean O'Malley, those are the expectations that are then placed upon you. And I know Vera, he made a fairly good account of himself. Let's be honest. Like, he turned Aldo into a grappler in the third round. He landed some good leg kicks. He absorbed the power of Aldo. Like, those are all good signs if you're then going to fight a guy like Davy Grant. Because I understand, the step from Sean O'Malley to Jose Aldo is immense. Like, I think Sean O'Malley's a really good fighter, but Jose Aldo's one of the greatest fighters ever. The great news from Marlon Vera is the step back down from Jose Aldo to Davy Grant is also pretty big, because I understand, and listen, I apologize to Davy Grant, but other than the Jonathan Martinez win, he really doesn't have a win on his record that says, wow, you're ready to go in there and beat a guy like Marlon Vera, because Davy Grant's a pretty good grappler, but he's not such a good grappler that I think he can go out there and just mop the floor with Marlon Vera. Marlon Vera has great transitions. Marlon Vera himself is a great defensive grappler. And then on the feet, what Grant did against Jonathan Martinez was impressive, don't get me wrong, but he just kept on landing one technique, and Jonathan Martinez couldn't adjust to it. That's great, like, Davy Grant still had to land that technique, but it was more on Martinez to not make those adjustments afterwards. I think if Davy Grant starts landing one technique on Marlon Vera, Marlon Vera is the guy who, A, can make adjustments mid-fight, because people forget this, he was known for being a late starter. This was a guy who used to lose every first round, have the second round be somewhat competitive, and then in the third round, completely blow the doors off his opponent. Like, I look at Marlon Vera as a guy that, even if he loses the first round against Davy Grant, he can still come back in the second and third. And if he wins the first round against Davy Grant, I just keep on expecting things to go his way.
You made a point saying that Marlon Vera, I mean, it's really tough to go from a loss to Jose Aldo back down. I mean, for Davy Grant, I think all he needed to come into this fight was a loss to Chris Holdsworth, and then he'd win again. He beat Marlon Vera again. He has already beaten him. I can't stress that enough. It was years ago.
It's a different fighter.
He has the win. Marlon Vera opened a minus 325. He's now minus 238. For Davey, he's still in the Navy. He opened a plus 275. Spit it out. He's a plus 190 underdog right now. If we head on over to Tapology, 794 total votes. 84% Vera. 56% by decision. 19% by submission. 20% by knockout. For the 16% that I've Grant, 51% by decision. 37% by knockout. I think Vera's going to win because, again, mid-fight adjustments, Perillo in the corner, decent boxing, better leg kick, adjusted head movement.
Great cardio.
I think he should be able to win this fight, but Davy Grant's proven people wrong his last two, and also he has a win over Marlon Vera, and usually the person that loses the first time doesn't win the second fight, but I think we are seeing a guy that was 23, now 28, who's made big leaps and bounds adjustments and has moved very far forward in his career. So I'm going with Ecuador's own Chito Marlon Vera.
To Davy Grant's credit, he has also improved a lot since their first fight, even though he is the older fighter out of the two. But I do agree. I think Marlon Vera has definitely made the more advancements out of these two fighters. And for Vera, he has a great opportunity to get back on track. You've got your win over O'Malley. That made you somewhat a star. You have your loss to Jose Aldo. No real shame. It's just you couldn't really get past that big hump to become a contender. Now you're fighting Davy Grant, much more back on your level. If he gets a big win here, I more than expect Marlon Vera to get a top 15 opponent next.
Matt, both of us going with Ruka Sports own Marlon Vera to get the win. Can't wait for it. Big time fight at 135 pounds. Big time fight at 145 pounds in our main event. Dan Ige challenging the now 8-time main eventer in a row. Consecutive. Insane.
Wild.
Chan Sung Jung, can't wait for it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Listen, summer's coming, and are you ready to unveil your beach bod? You're in luck. Our friends at Manscaped just launched their fourth generation performance package, which includes the Lawnmower 4.0 right there. You heard that right. The 4.0 complement your dad bod or six pack with a trim from the leaders in male grooming. The sun is shining and calling your name, fellas. So join the 2 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped to get ready for the hot summer. And they put hot guy summer, so apparently you're going to get ready for the hot guy summer with 20% off and free shipping. If you go to manscaped.com, use promo code FNP. Matt, listen, we've been in that situation where you got to trim before you go away on a trip. Now, I have to say, the nice thing with the Manscaped, and I'm the type of guy that for my day-to-day job, normally under regular circumstances, I'm traveling probably 2-3 times out of the week. So I have bought the cheaper trimmer that you get from the big box store. And then I left it on my luggage, and then I'm SOL. I'm out of batteries, and listen, once I get to the hotel, it's time for a meal, and then a nap, and then I'm gone. So that's pretty much it. But the nice thing with Manscaped, you fire that puppy up, you get the LED light, and that's great. If you triple tap it, 1, 2, 3, the three lights pop up. It's a travel lock, so it's not going to come on in your bag. And I'm not joking. That actually is a pretty good selling feature, and it works quite well. It comes with a couple of different guards, so if you're in shaving, maybe a little bit higher up, it does work quite well. And then again, they have a really nice charging stand that you get with it. So all sorts of great stuff. But listen, it really does help your confidence knowing that, listen, if you're traveling, that's not going to fire up in your bag. That's one of the worst things that could happen.
It really is. And we've talked about this before. You don't want rusty nuts. Of all the things you could have in your life, rusty nuts is probably at the top of the list for things you don't want, or at least in contention for it. And with those other ones, and we'll just say the big box store ones, they do have the metal razor, and that's a really big problem. If you're shaving in the shower, it's something you're always concerned about. You're concerned about just leaving it. It gets rusty. You might not notice it. It's the last thing you want is to nick your nuts with a rusty blade.
Well, the other thing, too, that's really nice about it is the fact that, and I'm not joking, you can pop the back off and you can clean inside.
Nice.
You can grease the little motor that's in there as well, so you know that you're going to be able to clean it out well. You know that it's going to be clean and it's going to be taken care of. As long as you take care of it, it'll take care of you. So that's what they should use.
Wow.
I mean, their copy, it's time to bundle up with Manscaped Performance Package 4.0. inside, you're going to find the Lawnmower 4.0 trimmer. I hit 1, 2, 3, I start it right back up, and so you get that. You also get the weed whacker, which is in my bathroom, because Matt, I've talked about it.
You use it.
I have really bad nose hair, and I use it, and sometimes I leave it there, but it is something that I use often enough. Now, I wouldn't go out there and say, you know, trim your nose hair every day, but I do have really bad nose hair. If you have bad ear hair as well, that's going to work well for you. They also have the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant. They have the Crop Reviver Toner. So let's pull that stuff out because it does work really well. Again, Crop Reviver, you spritz a little bit of that on in the morning. It's going to keep you fresh all day. The Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant, it's like a salve. You put it on, you lather it up. You don't want to put too much on, but it does work quite well. This performance package also comes with the performance boxer briefs and the travel bag. It's called the Shed. Everybody needs a good toiletry bag. Again, I travel quite a bit for my regular job, so it does work quite well for me. And you get that Lawnmower 4.0. It's the go-to ball hair trimmers. You just got to make sure you trim down and around, and you got to do a good job, but it does work quite well. So seal the deal with Manscaped's liquid formulations as well. And if you're over on the website, you can also pick up the refined cologne. I would suggest with this, it can be a little strong, spritz a little bit in the air, waft your way through it, and you're going to smell great for the day ahead. So Manscaped, they've even thrown in the two free gifts with the Performance Package 4.0, the boxers, the Shed travel bag. Bring your comfort and boxers to another level. Get 20% off and free shipping by going to manscaped.com/FNP. That's 20% off and free shipping. Use the promo code FNP at manscaped.com. Escape the shrubs and weeds this summer and shine with Manscaped. Matt, we get some big fights coming up this weekend. You're not going to want to miss this. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say,
let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up this weekend at heavyweight. We have the submission specialist, one win shy of 60. He's 1 month shy of 44. Alexei Olenek, the boa constrictor. He's taking on the polar bear, Sergey Spivak. Matt, animal references much?
There's been enough of them.
Have there? Well, we've got a big time fight. And for Sergey Spivak, this is a guy out of Moldova that you really didn't know what to expect. Now, I know there's a lot of fighters at heavyweight or thereabouts. I say that because maybe you're a cruiserweight, maybe you're a light heavyweight, that have experience with wins over Tony Lopez to come into the UFC. And that was the story the last time Spivak fought Vandera, because they both had the wins. But for Spivak, he was a WWFC champ. He beat Tony Lopez. He gets the UFC and he loses in 50 seconds to Wald Harris. So how good is he really? I just don't know. Well, then he goes out and he beats Tai Tuivasa handily. He loses to Marcin Tybura. He beats Carlos Felipe, where, again, did he get outstruck in one round? Maybe, but he looked great in that fight.
You need to stop with the Felipe hate.
And then he beat Jared Vandera handily his last time out in a fight that was weird because Jared Vandera called him out and then he gave Vandera the old up yours and did the Vandera to him.
We were joking. Like, that was the fastest challenge anyone's ever accepted in UFC history. Sergey Spivak could not wait to get into the cage with Jared Vandera because Vandera's all right. Like, he's a basic heavyweight striker. And Sergey Spivak, he's more than that. He's an all right striker. I guess the striking's not really the thing I'll focus on. But when I think about Sergey Spivak, this Tai Tuivasa fight, he was on fire. Like, he looked so good in that fight. I was like, damn, Sergey Spivak, not just top 15, like, Sergey Spivak, potential title one day. Like, I really thought Sergey Spivak, when you combine the level of ground and pound he had in that fight with the transitions and submissions, like, he just looked amazing in that fight. That was the best version of a Sergey Spivak fight. I can eat your power. I'm good enough defensively. I'll take you down, get you into my best spots, and I'll just thoroughly outclass you on the mat. And then it was so weird that he gets matched up with Marcin Tybura, a fighter very much known for the same thing.
Ships passing in the night in that fight, but I think you'll see Spivak carry that torch later on.
Exactly. And the thing about that fight was that Tybura was just overmatching Spivak physically. And I really think that that's actually going to be brought up again in this fight, because for Alexei Oleinik, in a lot of his fights, he is the smaller heavyweight. This is a guy who, for the large majority of his career, wasn't even a heavyweight. He fought Chael Sonnen on a Bodog card, okay?
At middleweight.
Alexei Oleinik has been around, okay? And like you had mentioned, one win shy of 60. We talked about experience being a factor, but with Alexei Oleinik, like, he's been in there and been against pretty much every version of every fighter there has been. So you know he's fought similar guys to Sergey Spivak. For me, though, Sergey Spivak and the physicality we talked about that he lacked in the Tybura matchup, he's going to have in this fight. Because for me, Sergey Spivak is a much younger version of Alexei Oleinik. He might not be the same submission threat that Oleinik is, don't get me wrong. He very much is a basic striker who really relies on their grappling to open up the rest of their game. Now, Oleinik, much more submission-based, whereas Spivak likes to use the ground and pound a little bit more to soften up his opponent. And if the submission is open, he will go for it. But for me, I don't see Oleinik taking down Spivak. I don't think he has the wrestling for it. And on the feet, although Oleinik might have a slightly higher uptick in his volume, I don't think he can do enough to go out there and just win rounds consistently against Spivak. So for me, I see this being one of those weird, Spivak's getting a lot of top control, but not really do a lot with it because he might be afraid of getting submitted, or Alexei Oleinik does the classic Alexei Oleinik and gets the weirdest submission we've ever seen. It's just, this is such a weird fight that these two ranked heavyweights are involved in.
Alexei Oleinik's been in the UFC for a while. He made his debut way back at UFC Fight Night 44. He beat Freight Train Hamilton. He was coming off of a win to get into the UFC over Mirko Krokop, where he beat him by neck crank.
Wow, boys.
Couple fights before that, he beat Jeff Munson. You want to get for free? He beat him by rear naked choke. Before that, he beat Tony Lopez, so everything comes full circle. And if you beat Tony Lopez,
you're good, my book.
Well, you either get f***ed for free by Jeff Munson, or you get knocked out by Wald Harris. A feat that both guys share. They've both been finished by Wald Harris. So credit where credit's due. One in about 50 seconds, one in 12 seconds. Alexei Oleinik is also, he holds a record for UFC heavyweights. Submission average per 15 minute, number one, Alexei Oleinik at 2.38. Number two, Frank Mir at 2.02. And behind him, Stefan Struve. So elite class. I mean, former champion and former would-be champion. Maybe, well, if he gets out of retirement, Stefan Struve. But this is an odd fight because, again, could Alexei Oleinik submit Sergey Spivak? Possibly. Spivak has that great Sambo background in his back pocket. He's only ever lost by, well, knockout to Wald Harris and decision to Marcin Tybura. And if you look at it for Oleinik, 2-3 in his last five. But again, the level of competition's weird, right? We have kickboxing's Alistair Overeem even before the five. We have Wald Harris, Maurice Greene, he submits. Verdum beats by split decision where he outstruck him. That was a weird fight.
Was.
Muay Thai artist and old man, Oleinik. Loses to Lewis where he almost finished him. And then loses to Chris Daukaus. Now, that was the bad one. Like, Daukaus went in there, hooks a blaze, and finished him easily.
Okay, so we're only now seeing LeBron James starting to slow down after, what, 18 seasons in the NBA? Alexi Olenek, and that's after, what, spraining his ankle, like, twice in 3 weeks, basically, this season.
Excuses, excuses.
Alexi Olenek's been knocked out two times over the age of 40. Like, this is supposed to happen. You will start to decline as you get older. The whole point is that it took a lot for LeBron to get to that point, and even now we're just starting to see him decline. Whereas Alexi Olenek, like, he has been knocked out lately. We have seen him be, we're seeing the decline of his skills, I think, to the point where 5 years ago, would he beat Sergei Spivak? Probably. He'd probably be able to get that takedown. He had a little bit more explosion behind his shots. I just don't think he can in the year 2021.
Yeah, for me, I mean, Sergei Spivak, I look at this one. Did the odds scare you? Maybe. Open to minus 250. He's minus 232 right now. On best fight odds for Alexei Olenek, open to plus 210. He's plus 184. 794 wow. Total Tapology votes, 71% Spivak, 78% by knockout. For the 29% that have Olenek, 78% by submission. I have a hard time seeing Olenek winning by any other means than a Hail Mary submission. Exactly. Now, for Spivak, he does like to clinch to get the takedown. Listen, Alexei Olenek loves the scarf holds. He loves the Ezekiel chokes. So, could he get Spivak? He certainly could. But for me, I'm going to go with the younger fighter here, out of Moldova and Sergei Spivak. You're in agreement here, right?
Yeah, I have to agree. I just think the top pressure will be enough to that. Olenek will be able to get some weird submission off of his back. And I do think the ground and pound of Sergei Spivak will be a big X factor in this fight.
He almost finished a future title challenger in Derek Lewis not that long ago, but we can't go with him. We're both going with Sergei Spivak. Let us know down below in the comments section who you are going with. And I can't wait to see these guys face off on weigh-in day as it plays into question mark kicks on to be determined date. So stay tuned for that, Matt. We have a big card coming up this weekend. You are not going to want to miss the next video. It is Korean Zombie taking on Dan Ige. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up this weekend in our main event at featherweight. We have the Korean Zombie, Chan Sung Jung, taking on 50K Dan Ige. Used to be Dynamite, but this guy gets bonuses. And you saw it his last time out with a huge win over fellow Canadian Gavin Tucker. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, Matt Allen, my brother. You can find him on Twitter and Instagram as well at Matt Allen FNP. Now, Matt, we have a big time fight coming up this weekend, and we talked about it at the start of the video. So if you missed it, go all the way back. But for the Korean Zombie, this is a guy that's main evented 7 times before that. This is his 8th main event in a row. And if you want to go way back and find his last 3-round fight, it was a very, very quick knockout over the hometown guy, Mark Hominick, at UFC 140 in Toronto, December of 2011. It's insane the run that this guy has gone on. And if you look at it, in his last 6 fights, little chintzy. I mean, he's 3-3 in the last 6. Dennis Bermudez knocked him out in the first round back in 2017. Knocked out Hanato Moicano 2019 in the first round. Knocked out Frank Yeager in the first round 2019. Fought Jose Aldo in 2013. Lost in the 4th round. That was for the title. The Rodriguez fight. The comeback fight. Like, he'd been away. 2018. Lost in the 5th round in the last second of that one. And then the Brian Ortega fight that he lost by decision, all 3 judges, 50-45, where he kind of looked like he lost a step, and that's what makes this fight so compelling, because Dan Ige has had the one misstep in his UFC career. Again, Julio Arce fight was close in his debut, UFC 220, went on a heater of a run, lost to Calvin Kattar handily in a main event where he got his ears boxed in. And then for Korean Zombie, he got his ears boxed in against the grappler who was making the comeback. This is a weird fight.
I have to throw us both under the bus right now because we both had terrible predictions based on both of... Well, you had one on one half of the main event. I had one in the other half of the main event. You said Gavin Tucker would beat Dan Ige. Now, I thought it was ridiculous and I look smart in hindsight. Now, I will also throw myself under the bus and I said Chan Sung Jung was going to destroy Brian Ortega. I didn't think that fight was going to be close at all. I thought Korean Zombie, you have no idea. Like, I thought he was going to go in there, TKO Brian Ortega like it was nothing, call it Max Holloway, and then we were banned for like one of the great fights of all time.
He looked terrible in that fight, though. And it was one of those weird fights where I think Chan Sung-jung, people know that his pressure has almost become a detriment to his game, where he moves forward with such reckless abandon that he has become hittable. And the real question mark for me is, how good is Chan Sung-jung's chin still? Because the Korean Zombie nickname, it's fun and all that, and like Justin Gaethje can be called the highlight, because although he's been knocked out 2 times, I know Justin Gaethje can eat a crazy amount of punches before he does get knocked out. Like in the Eddie Alvarez fight, he still ate about 55 overhands, and in the Poirier fight he ate about 55 overhands, and then he eventually went down. But with Chan Sung-jung, it is starting to get to the point now where when you hit him clean, he does at least get rocked from it. If you go back to Dennis Bermudez fight, where yes, Dennis Bermudez, especially at that time, was a much different fighter than I guess we look back upon him now as, but he was a real legit top fiver who was going in there and having crazy fights with a lot of guys. And the fact that he was able to rock Chan Sung-jung, it wasn't all that surprising, but knowing what we know now, it kind of is, because for the Korean Zombie, you don't get that nickname by getting rocked by guys like Dennis Bermudez. You eat damage and you walk forward. And I know it's just a nickname and whatnot, but it is his style. Like, he has to rely on his durability to have success. He is a guy who does rely on the fact that I can eat 2 shots to land one, because my one shot is so much more damaging than my opponent's 2. But when we saw in that Brian Ortega fight, and he even said so afterwards, he gets hit by that beautiful spinning elbow that Ortega throws, and then he's just not in the fight whatsoever. And he said, like, oh, I was rocked, and I never really felt like I could get back into the fight after that. And if you want to take him at his word and listen, there's no reason not to, then yes, that kind of explains his bad last few rounds, but it will be interesting to see how he eats the power of Dan Ige, because for as much as Dan Ige, yes, the nickname's Dynamite and 50 Gay, he's not really a knockout artist. Like, he's a good boxer, he's got good hands and whatnot, but I don't really look at Dan Ige as like an Edson Barbosa in this division, where it's like, wow, you really gotta watch out for the power. He's a great well-rounded mixed martial artist who can offer guys a lot of looks, but I always feel like with Dan Ige, and I do feel like the Calvin Kattar fight speaks to this, he is always kind of a step behind those pure specialists of the division.
Now, when I look at this one, for Chan Sung-jung, you know, he does do some training at Korean Zombie MMA over in Korea. But if you look at it, trains at a Fight Ready MMA. Now, listen, we always talk about Fight Ready. We talked about it a lot last weekend, and I think it plays a little bit here. So hear me out. Eric Anders took on Darren Stewart. Eric Anders was always an SBG Alabama guy. He relied on his athleticism and his takedowns. And yeah, did he do a little bit of that in his last fight against Darren Stewart? Well, for sure.
Terrible fight.
But his last 2 camps have been at Fight Ready MMA with Eddie Cha as a striking coach. And Eddie's really made some improvements in Eric Anders' game. Eddie Cha, of course, in the corner for this one. And you look at it and listen, you could hear it in Anders' last fight that he was really picking up on the clear instructions that you could hear over the broadcast from Eddie Cha. He was yelling combinations. He was yelling about his footwork. If we can get any of that with the Korean Zombie, obviously it's a really big help. So it's definitely worth mentioning. But if you do look at it as far as training partners at Fight Ready, Marco Madsen's over there right now. You're going to get that wrestling look for a fight like this. Leandro Higo, who just had a really big win over with Bellator, and some other maybe usual suspects that you have. Bruno Silva, not the guy fighting this weekend that had to fight the USADA scandal, the little guy. Shaymon Moraes, who had a big win with PFL just last week. And then if you want it, Hunter Azure, good wrestler. Jonathan Pierce, long striker, close to this division. And then throw another one in there, similar division, Luis Saldana. So a lot of really good guys in those lower weight classes, bodies that you can get in to get a striking look, to get a wrestling look, to get a grappling look. And I like that for the Korean Zombie. But the same thing can be said for Dan Ige coming out of Extreme Couture, where there's no shortage of fighters in lower weight classes.
Without a doubt. And the good thing for Chan Sung-jung, like you talked about, he does have a plethora of training partners who are going to help him train the specific things that Dan Ige excels at. The one thing, though, for Dan Ige, and again, this fight for me does come down to the Korean Zombie's ability to accept damage. Because for Ige, a very compact fighter at 145, not a big guy for the weight division, kind of reminds me of like Ally Quinta at 55. Not too big for the weight class, not too small, just a perfect guy for the weight class. Like, he's going to be bigger than some guys, but smaller than like the truly huge. Like, look at his fight against Edson Barbosa. Edson was huge compared to Dan Ige. And I understand there was a very controversial decision in which me and many others believe Edson Barbosa won, but it was still a good performance by Dan Ige. Not many guys can eat like an overhand right elbow into an overhand right from Edson Barbosa, get dropped, and then still get up to get a takedown on him. Like, Dan Ige showed a great chin and great heart throughout that fight. for me, this is one of two things. It's either going to be a Y'all Must Have Forgot by the Korean Zombie, where it's he's going to land one beautiful boxing combo like he did against Frankie Edgar, rock Danny Ige, take him down, probably ground and pound him or submit him, because the Korean Zombie really does have great jiu-jitsu, which is not something that really gets talked about. Similar to like a Jose Aldo. We brought up his grappling against Marlon Vera. Jose Aldo is so known for his striking that he never really has to use his grappling, but it is in his back pocket. And I do look at the Korean Zombie that way. Like, he trained with Henner Gracie a lot. This was while he was off due to his mandatory military service for South Korea. He was still training and getting better during his time off, and that's just a great thing to see from Chan Sung Jung. But for me, I keep on going back to that Brian Ortega performance, and I know I talked about the improvements that he makes. He just looks so bad in that fight.
And that's the thing. I mean, you look at the Korean Zombie, you talk about the accumulation of damage, you look at the career strike differential that's 0.14 out of a striker. That's not good. You like to see it like a big differential over a long career. Not good, but the takedown defense, 75%. He didn't get taken down, you know, layoff or not, for over 7 years. It was between the Aldo fight to the Ortega fight. That's insane. That's really, really good. And he did have fights in between. So you do like to see that. But for Dan Ige, again, had a poor performance against a very good pure boxer in Calvin Kattar in a main event at the Apex facility. For the Korean Zombie, his last fight, again, a main event, that one was over at Fight Island. So it'll be interesting to see how he acclimatizes in Vegas for this fight. Obviously, he's been in Phoenix training for it, yeah. So it shouldn't be too bad, but something of note. So I do look at this one. Again, we talk about Ige. Let's mention a couple training partners before we move too far on. Patchy Mix, Mads Brunel, Jeremy Kennedy. Those are the guys in the lower weight classes that'll give you a good look. Jason Jack.
Justin James,
who I meant to say. What else? Kai Kamaka, Boston Salmon, Gustavo Lopez. These are all the
say
names
less, Craig.
That I had written down. But a guy that's been posting a lot of strength and conditioning on his Instagram. So you do like to see that out of Ige in a 5-round fight with a guy like Zombie that's pretty hard to put away. Lots of clips over there. You can check them out. Matt, I look at this one and I was kind of surprised by the odds, actually, because it's a pick 'em fight.
Makes sense, though.
They're both a -110. If we look at Fight Night picks in the YouTube community tab, 52% have Ige to 48% that have Chan Sung Jung. 1,400 total votes, which is more than they actually have over on Tapology, where 61% have Jung and 39% have Ige. So the Fight Night picks fans right now have Ige. The Tapology fans have Chan Sung Jung, the Korean Zombie. So what are you ultimately thinking here?
This might take me a second to fully articulate my prediction, but just bear with me. I think Dan Ige is going to land first in this fight. The problem that Chan Sung Jung has a lot, if you go all the way back to the Aldo fight, everything he throws is a hook. He has great power, don't get me wrong, but it's because of the style of punches he throws. There's a lot of overhands, a lot of hook punches. Most guys do beat him because of their straight shots. And for Dan Ige, he is known for, he's got a great jab, he's got a great right hand, and he is a very defensively sound fighter too. He's always got his hands up, which is the exact opposite of the Korean Zombie. So for me, it comes down to, if Dan Ige lands on the Zombie and he hurts him, then Dan Ige is going to win this fight. He's going to keep on landing first over and over again. If Zombie can weather some of those early shots of Dan Ige and start to land in combination as this fight goes on, I do see it being Zombie's fight to lose. But for me, I do have to side with Dan Ige. I like what I saw in his last fight against Gavin Tucker. And listen, I understand it was only a minute, but he does have deceiving power, I would say. And even I don't put a lot of stock into Dan Ige's power because I think he's a guy who really prioritizes his technique over just trying to hit a guy hard with one shot. Like, Dan Ige, I understand he got out-volumed by Calvin Kattar, and Calvin Kattar's the faster guy to those two. He just is. But for Dan Ige, he's going to have above-average power, I would say, and above-average volume. And I think that nowadays, that's what you need to beat the Korean Zombie. The Korean Zombie could go out there, hit him with one long combination, hurt Dan Ige, and then put him away. But I just don't think that's going to happen this weekend.
I mean, for me, Dan Ige's output is just about on par so far through the UFC, albeit against a lower level competition the Korean Zombie's had. But again, it's right on par to about what he absorbs. His strikes absorbed, it's a little bit low. You like to see it. Good defense on both sides, like you said. Listen, he's the type of guy that he'll give up a takedown if it really needs to happen because he's so good in the scrambles. He's so good with his jiu-jitsu.
And just to build upon that, like, Dan Ige's not a guy in my head who I ever think gets held down. Like, when he does get taken down, like you had just said, he immediately pounces back up to his feet. Like, he's very confident in his own wrestling that way, where, like you said, he can give up a takedown just to make his opponent work because he has so confident in his ability to get back up.
To me, the tricky thing is, though, Dan Ige's got to mix every tool that he has to win this fight. I don't think he can purely do it. Maybe he hits a lucky early, you know, not lucky. It's definitely going to be placed. But if he's able to place a really good hard shot early, maybe he's able to put the Korean Zombie away. That would be insane. Brian Ortega couldn't do it. But I do like the Korean Zombie in this fight, because if he does draw Ige into those exchanges, Korean Zombie with the volume, with the footwork, everything can kind of work.
Be a great
now
fight.
Does stand quite high up, does leave his head out there. You worry about it a little bit. But again, I do see this one being very, very close. And for me, it was a really, really hard one to pick. I've been on the fence. So yeah, it is true.
It's kind of wild how this fight got put together, though, because everybody has to remind themselves. Like, Dadege called out the Korean Zombie before the Gavin Tucker fight was ever put together. He was like, hey, we're both coming off losses in main events. This would make sense. Chan Sung Jung basically did the Jeremy Stevens, like, who the fuck is that guy? Didn't know who Dadege was. Dadege knocks out Gavin Tucker in 10 seconds. And then Chan Sung Jung's like, hey, I know who you are now. And then this fight gets signed. So for Dadege, like, completely changed the trajectory of his career with one impressive performance. So for Dadege, he is right back to where he was pre-Calvin Kattar fight. And this is a huge opportunity for both men.
I mean, hey, you make your own conclusions from this one, because we are both split. Matt's got Ige, I've got the Korean Zombie. Absolutely love this fight and can't wait for the fights coming up on Saturday. So, little bit of a twist this week. I've got a weird schedule. This is the first Saturday that I'm going to miss, and I know exactly when it was. It was
Curtis Blaydes against Derek Lewis, but then it fell out.
It was Dan Ige's last time out. What was it? Or it was Dan Ige's time out in May of last year. That was way back on a fight night card. That was Overeem Harris. That was the last card that I missed on a Saturday. It's
That's
crazy.
Wild.
I was out in the woods camping. I'm doing the same thing this Saturday. So, all that to say, I'm going to be in a remote location. We're going to do question mark kicks however we can. It's going to happen, so just stay tuned, please. I can't stress it enough. You can follow us at Fight Night Picks on Instagram and Twitter. You can follow me at Craig Allen FNP, Matt at Fight Night Picks. But we're very active on Twitter, maybe more so than Instagram. There's always a story out there because I make sure I always post, or you post on the Instagram story. So there's always something to check out. But in the community tab on YouTube as well, we will alert you. We'll let you know when that show is going to happen, because we're not going to let you hang on that one. So it's going to happen. I'm going to make it happen from probably out in the woods. But you can bet your ass it's going to happen. So, really looking forward to it. Big card coming up this weekend. Make sure, please, you keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. And one other thing. We are just a few hundred subscribers shy of 25,000. So if you're just hanging out on the periphery thinking, geez, these guys are doing a decent job, they're not just skinny, long vampires that are out there for a good time. Maybe we are.
I got a little more sun.
But just hit that sub, hit that like, and you'll know when question mark kicks is going to happen as well. So, as always, we say with Fight Night Picks, Matt,
let's get into it.